Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Most accounts of U.S. business history start with the Industrial Revolution, the railroads, New England factories. Slavery doesn't usually come into it. Our guest today, Caitlin Rosenthal, says we need to take a much closer look at the part slavery has played in business and management. In her research, she's found examples of modern management practices buried in the ledgers of plantation owners. She says we won't really understand what enslaved people were up against until we reckon with how sophisticated those management systems were. And we can't have a full understanding of modern management unless we're willing to look deeper at some of the painful aspects of its history.
There's just huge numbers of books about famous entrepreneurs, about steam engines and railroads and computers, about things where it's relatively easy to tell a triumphant story. And by contrast, this makes people really, really uncomfortable. In some cases, innovation and violence went together and built on each other. And that's totally contrary to most narratives of innovation. In Germany after the Holocaust, and really up to today, there continue to be huge numbers of business histories grappling with these uncomfortable legacies. And we don't have anywhere near the same thing grappling with the history of American business and slavery.
Caitlin Rosenthal is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. She's the author of the book Accounting for Slavery, Masters and Management. Caitlin, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. I'm excited to have this conversation.
How did you come to focus on this topic in the first place?
Well, I sometimes say that I'm probably the only person to write a history of slavery by accident. Right out of undergrad, I went to work for McKinsey & Company as a management consultant, and I spent 3 years as a business analyst, you know, the person at the bottom of the team who has the spreadsheet. And while I was there, I got really interested in the emergence of scale in American businesses. So what happens when businesses get so big that managers and owners continue to know about them through data, but they actually don't know the workers themselves? So when I applied to graduate school in history, I was interested in studying the emergence of scale. And in my first semester of research, I dug into the archives for where I assumed that story would start. Northern factories that employ free labor, especially textiles and iron mills. But in the middle of that research, an economic historian handed me an example of a plantation account book. And it was just much, much more sophisticated than the average practices that I had seen in northern factories. As I began to follow it, I found other examples that showed slaveholders using many of the same practices that are usually considered to be milestones in the emergence of modern business. So the question I had was, what would the history of American business practices look like if we fully considered slavery? How could we write slavery back into that history?
I'm curious to know more about kind of these records and how you saw them sort of differently than other scholars, because they were being used in some cases by social historians or, you know, people sort of looking at other aspects of this, but you really came along and said, oh, there's a business story to be told here. Why is it important to get that economic aspect back on the table when we talk about the system of slavery?
So I don't think I would have been able to see it if I hadn't been coming to the records as someone who'd just been keeping data myself. I think coming to it as someone who'd been doing business practices put me in the position of the planter, which is a really uncomfortable position to be in. And it was partly like my discomfort at relating so easily to the planter and what the planter was able to do that made me want to work on the project. And the fact that I could see this economic story, I think, is especially important because it can help us to acknowledge how massive the slave experience was and kind of what an important thing we have to grapple with. I mean, if we're thinking about where did our economy come from, this is a huge part of the American economy during the period. Even, you know, I mentioned those textile industries where the records didn't look quite as good. But, of course, they were spinning cotton that was grown by enslaved people. If you look at the banking industry, this is not my own research, but there are scholars studying the mortgages and the amount of liquidity that enslaved people provided because they could be collateralized in producing loans. So the kind of idea is to take something that people have said, well, this was a bad thing, but mostly the story is good, and say, well, actually, the story is kind of more deeply complicated than that. And if we want to move forward from it, it's going to take a deeper reckoning.
Why is slavery so often left out of business history?
Well, there's a number of different reasons. One is, you know, after the American Civil War, all kinds of things conspired to lead people to forget about some of these stories. Both the interests of abolitionists and the interests of Southern planters were to suggest that slavery was backwards and unprofitable. On the one hand, to make the slaveholders feel better about what they'd been doing, and on the other hand, the abolitionists wanted us to think we were doing away with an institution that was inefficient. But since then, there have been lots of moments where business historians and other scholars have actually tried to remind us of the relevance of slavery to the history of management, so much so that in 2002 there was an article, or I think it's 2003, by a management scholar where he said, you know, actually we're in denial about the relevance of slavery to the history of American business practices, because if you go read secondary sources on American business and on American slavery, you can immediately see that planters are doing some of the same things that business people did.
Mm. I'd like to hear specifically some of the parallels you found, because I think in the details, some of these disturbing parallels do start to come to life. What are some of the sort of surprising things you discovered about practices that planters were using, even if it's uncomfortable to think of it as management?
So one thing that's interesting is the complexity of the management organizations that plantations had to rely on. These were huge enterprises. The large ones were hundreds, but the very large ones were thousands of enslaved people. And to manage an enterprise of that scale, you need not only an owner and an overseer, but you need numbers of middle managers. Alfred Chandler, who's probably the most renowned American business historian, wrote in his book, The Visible Hand, which is the most prominent business history, that plantation overseers were in many ways the first salaried managers in the country. He didn't conclude then that that made plantations particularly modern. But as I continued to pore through plantation records, I found that not only do we have overseers, but we have under them white managers, sometimes called bookkeepers. And beneath them, you have enslaved managers, head drivers, head watchmen, head smiths and carpenters, each of whom are responsible for managing different aspects of plantation production. Another thing that's really interesting is the way plantations and planters did cost accounting. So one of the key developments in the emergence of modern business is the idea that you should analyze your products to see exactly how much everything costs. And related to this is the analysis of depreciation. So thinking about how a large fixed cost, like a railroad train, might change in value over time and how you should account for that. In one of the most prominent accounting guides for planters, Thomas Affleck's Plantation Record and Account Book, he gives advice on how to appreciate and depreciate enslaved people. For him, these are long-lived, complex capital assets. They're human capital. He doesn't call them that, but he gives instructions on how to account for their growth in value as they get older, as they learn new skills, and how to account for their depreciation as they age or if they're injured or even if they attempt to escape.
Mm, wow. When you say something like a finding like that is interesting, interesting is one of those words that can contain a multitude of meanings. You know, it's sometimes it's like, oh, that's so interesting. And it's this kind of, it means that your ears perk up. And other times you're like, it's like a gift that you don't want. You're like, oh, thank you for the sweater. It's very interesting. So I'm just, when you as a scholar say that you find something interesting, what is like behind that? What's in there?
Well, depreciation is something that I'd gotten used to seeing as a sign of remarkable sophistication. It doesn't show up in accounting textbooks until the late 19th century. And here we are half a century earlier, and we have a Southern planter instructing people how to appreciate and depreciate enslaved people. So that means that he was well ahead of his time in a setting that I had gotten used to thinking about as being one that was relatively backwards, one that wasn't sophisticated. So it changed the way I saw the records that plantations were producing. I started to think about these records as a kind of proto-spreadsheet. There are remarkable records of records that I never would have expected to find that show how much cotton every enslaved person who's working on a plantation picked every single day. West Indian plantations actually produced these monthly reports that summarized all of the data from the plantation onto a single sheet. And as I went, I started to think about these monthly abstracts as if they were kind of dashboards of productivity. And they were folded up and they were shipped back across the Atlantic Ocean to absentee planters who could peruse these from the comfort of their desk and really think about managing their plantation without having to confront a lot of the really problematic and terrible, terrible things that were actually happening on the ground.
It's something about that is very eerie to me to hear that because, you know, I keep a spreadsheet where I have kind of the weekly output of HBR.org and how much content are we producing and how does it kind of change how you think about some of these management techniques to know that they were being used in this context that is unexpected for people who are still using some of these techniques like depreciation or productivity measures today?
First, I just want to compound what you said about being careful about the comparisons. I mean, the fact that enslaved people couldn't quit was everything.
Mm.
So the sister circumstances are quite different. At the same time, I think it should lead people to ask, what were these measurements designed to reveal? If you're looking at these measurements, and the same measurements could be used on a slave plantation, then those measurements aren't designed to kind of help enslaved people or to help you become a more humane manager. They're designed to help maximize the value and the surveillance of human capital. And if you want to use those metrics for different purposes, then it's going to be a difficult job to do that because the first thing that pops out of them is about productivity and about profitability. And kind of it's, in a way, an uphill battle to turn metrics produced to reveal profit into something that can help us to be more humane.
Yeah, there's like something strange about the contrast there. Some research that I've followed in my work is like the paperwork of terrorist organizations. You know, Al-Qaeda asks their quote-unquote employees to do expense reports. You know, if you buy things that you for your work in Al-Qaeda, you have to send something back to headquarters saying, hey, this is what I spent, pay me back. And in some ways, it is weird and disturbing to hear about the intersection of management and violence in that way.
And on plantations, I think there's something about the fact that people are enslaved that makes them easier to measure and monitor.
Mm.
So, I mean, it's not even just that they're using the same tools, it's that paperwork was really well adapted to people who couldn't quit. I reference those Northern factory books, and sometimes one of the reasons that people weren't successful at keeping lots of data is that people were quitting all the time. A lot of Northern factories had 100% turnover. By contrast, if an enslaved person doesn't show up to work, usually the planter knows exactly where they are, and he knows when he can demand that they return to work. So the fact that planters have control over people turns them into data much more fluidly. I mean, that's not quite the right word, but it makes it easier to keep track of them using paperwork.
Context of white supremacy. The main business on this here planet, keeping track of Negroes. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, November 16th, 2018. So I have been told this is our weekly broadcast, Neutralizing Workplace Racism. If folks have figured out, I make an effort to consistently say, if we have any victims of racism, white supremacy in the known universe, who have figured out some things that work well on the job, where you are not being mistreated, abused, lashed, having your seat moved every other day, you should be the first person to dial in and let us know what you did to put yourself in that situation. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. And I will pause just for a moment. I don't say that just, you know, as something as words to waste before we get to callers or, you know, play another audio segment. I mean, in the spirit of being attempted counter racists, what Dr. Welsing, you know, wanted us to be solving this problem for folks, you know, who regularly listen, participate, especially in this program, Workplace Racism. This is not about being a spectator, and it's not even about, you know, just emulating what is said here. It's about, you know, really thinking, following the logic, and trying to come up with codes, strategies. These are things that non-white people can implement. At least you can say, hey, these are things based on my work situation. I did some thinking, did some studying, and I came up with at least one or two things, you know, based on the code that we have in these circumstances. This seems to work well to solve this problem. We should really be thinking about that if we're on the job and trying to share that, really thinking about counter-racism in that manner. And some folks do that with the note taking and adjusting your code. We've had people who've called in who talked about with the recorder I was thinking with Emmy. She made the adjustment. Now I announce that this is being recorded. Boop, that way I can use it moving forward if need be. And I can use it for myself. Call in Florida as well. I'll be making adjustments to your own personal code and seeing where things that work well. That really is something that all of us should be working on. So whether you're listening live or to the archives, this is not about spectating. Certainly, if we have listeners who are having problems with regards to racism, white supremacy on the job, certainly dial in and we will do our best to offer counter-racist logic to approach your situation without creating new problems, something we always want to keep in mind. But the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you are not able to dial in via phone, you can email untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Drop an email and we can read your commentary on the air. Or if you have a question, we can give response on the air as well. A few things that I wanted to address before we get to callers. First and foremost, out of all of the things that took place over this week, again, hopefully we do not have any cows listeners in the path of the fires happening down in California. Hopefully, no non-white people being negatively impacted. But out of all the things that, you know, happened over this past week, the Golden State Warriors, two-time defending NBA champions, attracted so much attention this week with two of their non-white, victim of white supremacy players having a verbal spat, name-calling in, you know, broad daylight right in front of the cameras. Two-time defending champions, you know, looked at as one of the greatest basketball teams of all time, and two of their best players, all-stars, Olympic gold medalists, no less, black males name-calling each other. Why? I mean, just no name calling, and particularly in a workplace setting. And we've talked about it. That's what the reason that I'm mentioning it. In a workplace setting, you really do not want to be in a habit of name calling other Black people, really anybody, but particularly other Black people, where it gets into, you know, where you've kind of got upset and whites have to intervene about, you know, how the quarrel is going to be handled. And that's what happened in this situation. Whites had to intervene and decide that they were going to suspend one of the Black males. But I mean, wow, Black self-respect. And we do not want to engage in behaviors that are going to create more problems. That's what I said previously. Just bare minimums with regards to how we conduct ourselves on the job, because I get the impression that that happens a lot. Racists, they have created so much anti-Blackness and have all of us functioning. Well, that's just it. We're just constantly in conflict with one another. We end up being quarreling with other non-white people on jobs, and then whites, they intervene. And sometimes they do what they did in this situation. We're going to send you home, you know, for a few days without your pay. I don't think he lost pay, but he did get sent home. Sometimes it'll be, we're going to send both of you home. Sometimes it'll be, we're going to send you both home permanently. Never know. Racists get to decide. Moving forward, let's see. There was, or if you see the image that is attached to the description advertisement for this particular episode of Workplace Racism, Neutralizing Workplace Racism, the image, it says, four former employees file racial harassment complaints against Vivint Smart Home. Now, this is in the great state of Utah. I think they have an elected Black official in Utah. Not very many Negros in that state. Just thought it was appropriate to read some of the details of this report. This came out yesterday, Thursday. Four former Vivint Smart Home employees have filed racial harassment complaints against the Provo, Utah-based company just months after two former Vivint Solar employees filed similar lawsuits in June. The four men, who all identify as Black or quote-unquote Latino, filed lawsuits in mid-October in the Superior Court of California in Los Angeles claiming racial harassment, retaliation, wrongful termination, and racial discrimination by coworkers, according to court documents. The complaints come just 4 months after two men, one white and the other Black, leveled allegations of a racist and hostile work environment at a Vivint Solar office in California after a supervisor and other workers repeatedly assembled a cardboard fort in the warehouse and spray painted "white only" on the outside. I remember that. While Vivint Solar and Vivint Smart Home are two separate entities, both are controlled by the same private equity firm in New York, and both grew out of APX Alarm, a Provo, Utah company founded nearly 20 years ago. The two also have a strategic partnership, according to a post on Vivint Smart Home's website. I will just pause for Mr. Fox, who uploads the Cows content at YouTube. Voltron. Great illustration right there. White people network better than anyone. Woo. Continuing, it sounds like there's a real cultural problem in Vivint Smart Home and Vivint Solar, said Corey Bennett, a California attorney from the San Francisco office of Matern Law Group, who represents all four Vivint Smart Home employees, as well as the two Vivint Solar employees. One of the plaintiffs, Christopher Brown, claimed that shortly after he arrived in California to start work as a sales representative for Vivint Smart Home, his supervisor began using the word nigger and making racist comments, like describing how ghetto Black people were in his neighborhoods and asking things like, do Black people normally ... or how do Black people, according to the court documents. The lawsuit also alleges that Brown's supervisor once said, stay focused in school because if you get distracted by drugs, it will postpone everything for who knows how long. Ask Chris Brown, and a coworker was astonished. The supervisor would suggest that Brown would know that because he was black, court documents state. The same supervisor also posted a Snapchat video from inside the home of a black family. The video showed a baby in a diaper and rap music playing on a TV and included the caption, "Do you think they'll pass credit?" According to the court documents, those hoping to purchase Vivint smart home products often have a certain credit score to qualify to purchase them. Brown filed a complaint with the EEOC Commission in August, then spoke with the Human Resources Department in the company. A month later, Brown got an email from the office saying that they had received statements from all parties involved and had taken the necessary steps to discipline and train the offenders mentioned in your complaint, according to court documents. If a company takes a complaint seriously from the moment that it's made and takes whatever appropriate disciplinary action it deems, which could include suspension, firing, organizing some sort of harassment or disciplinary training that can help sort of mitigate the damage but not necessarily eliminate it, Bennett said. I will stop there. I will add complaint. I do recommend, and Mr. Fuller says this regularly, he said it for years, we are not ever making a complaint and reporting about being abused on the job. You are making a report. And he has even said if they have a complaint, sometimes it'll be on the form that you might have to fill out. If it's on the form, he's recommended crossing out the word complaint and write in report. Again, just words are critically important with regards to racism, white supremacy, especially on the job. Complaint makes it sound like, again, you're just a little child. Your feelings are hurt. I'm sad or I'm hurt. I'm upset because, you know, somebody, you know, looked at me funny. And that's not what this is at all. We're making a report of incorrect behavior, violations of company policy and procedure, perhaps. But same shenanigans as usual in the report. I would have been documenting the entire time. This would have been great to have all of that recorded, the how do black people and all of that. And again, you do not want to get upset, say that all the time. We talk about not being surprised about any of this behavior. And what I said before about researching, this would have been a great one to research that, oh, they've had this sort of thing happen before with the company. What I said, if you join a company or organization, take some time, do some searches online to see if there have been other incidents of racism, white supremacy at this company. That should be added to your file, your folder for, you know, what you're doing while, as long as you're employed with that organization. Next, the article that we heard at the beginning of the program. Wow. Fascinating segment from the Harvard Business Review. A listener shared a report or segment that they had earlier this year that was talking about why black people, or it said minorities, why they have a difficult time opening up in the workplace. It did not have quality information in that report, but that segment, the one that we opened up with today, I thought was fascinating. Caitlin Rosenthal, Suspected Racist White Woman, Accounting for Slavery was the book that she was talking about, Masters and Management, talking about the relationship in terms of how business practices and business management has evolved from the practice of slavery, terrorizing Negroes. I found it fascinating in so many different regards, particularly surveillance. That's something that we emphasize not just on this program, but on this specific segment, workplace racism, consistently. I think at least for the last year or so, that's been something. You are under surveillance, and talking about that going all the way back to the plantation and how it evolved. It became more sophisticated. Their methods for not just tracking, but documenting, recording every ounce of cotton that Negroes picked. We talked about that in Edward Baptist. The half has never been told. I was wondering if she was going to mention that as one of the reference points. But just talking about that and imagining how sophisticated that system is now When we each and every day, regardless of where you work, if it's an office setting or if you drive a vehicle or whatever the environment is, imagine how sophisticated it is now, not just with whites networking with each other, but then all the, you know, sophisticated electronics and everything. Keeping that in mind at all times, you are under surveillance. But I found it fascinating. It validated consistently. Plantation, that's the way that we should be thinking about the workplace. This is the plantation. That's what all of this is modeled from. So many things stood out. If folks want to check out the book, feel free, might be worth a read, or at least to see if we can nab her perhaps to be a guest on the program. Anywho, with that, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I thought it was interesting. That was the important no mention of rape every time, in my view, if the topic of slavery is going to be mentioned. And I played so much of that segment. There were more things that I was going to say about it. If you're going to have that much, we didn't even play the whole interview. The whole interview was like 30 minutes. You have that much time to talk about slavery. There's no way that rape cannot be mentioned as critical, foundational as the rape of black people was to the maintenance of slavery. That is, in my view, a conscious, willful, deliberate act of white supremacy for a informed. This is not an ignorant white woman to talk that long about this and not mention rape. And you could have connected that right to 2018 Me Too and unwanted touching, sexual harassment in the workplace, that too goes all the way back to the plantation. In fact, that would be one I'd want to ask for the interview. But anyway, she doesn't make any mention of that at all in the book. And that goes directly to when you begin talking about depreciation, appreciation on the plantation. The other quick thing, when she said enslaved, that was the term that she used when discussing the management of Negroes. And I said earlier this year, I'm not going to use that term. I'm just going to say slaves. It does not make me feel any better. I don't think it's constructive. And in fact, I think there's so much confusion about what it means to be a slave, the system of white supremacy being slavery, that I think it would be better. In fact, it would have really, in my view, been correct if she had just been, oh yeah, Negroes. Managing Negroes, that has a big impact on, you know, how we think about business today. Oh yeah, going all the way back to how they treat, that would, perfect. She could have said Negroes, that would have been fine too, but I mean, it's no need to try to make this seem better than what it is. Let's just be accurate, correct, even if that's hurtful and coarse. Let's just be correct and direct with terminology. Words are important. Same thing I just said. Now, number 641-715-3640, code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If folks have a code about helping to make sure that you minimize conflict. There we go. Minimize conflict with other black people in the workplace so that it does not become a Golden State Warrior thing where you're name calling and it's got real hostile and ugly with you and another black person in the workplace. That would be grand. That does seem to come up quite a bit. As I said, for years, that was all we could seem to talk about on workplace racism. So if people have some codes to help, you know, make sure that it doesn't get there and to make sure that white people don't have to intercede, because that's what happened. Make sure that it doesn't get there. Let's see if we can squash this between us so that, you know, because they could come and say that we all going to, you know, be playing for, who knows, the Phoenix Suns or what have you. Folks that dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guys. Greetings to everyone on the line. Like to share a couple incidents at the workplace. So I'm in my workspace, my particular office, so to speak, and I just overhear there's a white male or white man in this early to mid 20s talking to our white male supervisor, who's I suspect he's in his 50s or whatever. And I don't know the context behind this conversation, but I just overheard them. I didn't hear what they said prior to this, but I just overheard the older white male, the supervisor, saying something about Eazy-E. And I heard the younger white male saying to him, I know that they said that Suge Knight confessed to murdering Tupac. Did you know that? And they kind of started laughing. So again, I don't know the context. What I definitely feel is some type of racism was being practiced at that time, because there was no reason for them to really be discussing that at the workplace. And I don't know if they were saying that loud enough for me to hear, which is very possible. But I suspect they were practicing racism. And also, so I was speaking with this same white male supervisor. He was asking about a particular machine that we have that uses batteries, and the machine wasn't working at the time. And I was asking him, like, what type of battery does it use? I know that it used a large battery, and I didn't know if it was a C battery or a D battery. And I was like, is it a C or a D? And he said, yeah, I think it's a D battery. And then he said, then he paused for a second. Then he said, D mother effing batteries. So, and again, I think that was, I think it was, that was a quote from, or a scene from Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing movie with Radio Raheem or whatever. But again, I thought he was practicing racism there. And that just goes to show that these white people, again, with them, we're always under surveillance, as you just said, Gus. They're very aware, very keen to all our little anything, movies, music, all types of, they're constantly studying us, studying our behavior patterns and everything. And yet they feign, ignorance when it comes to, pointing out that they practice racism. And lastly, black female that I work with, pregnant, currently pregnant, she's has high risk pregnancy right now. And so basically her doctor put her on. No, Gus, it's actually her. She has another condition that has to do with her nerves that makes her high risk, and her age on top of that too. She's over 35. So from what I've been told, but it hasn't been high blood pressure. So her doctor put her on a bed rest for a while, and then later told her to, hey, the job that you're performing, which what she gets paid to do, she cannot perform it because it requires her to be in, certain positions that is putting a lot of pressure on certain parts of her body, of course, and it could cause her to go into early labor. So she gives this paperwork to, supervisor, and then that gets to HR, of course, and they're telling her, like, hey, the supervisor, and I don't know, he's seeming to say, hey, okay, this is no problem. We'll put you in, assign you some work to where you won't have to be, standing for long periods of time or sitting in a certain position for long periods, lifting the stuff that, that she was restricted from doing. And there was some paperwork that needed to be done associated with that to assure that she would have these accommodations. So she also spoke with the EEO, and they gave her certain, hey, these are the forms you need to fill out. This is the proper protocol to get this done so that you can have these approved accommodations. But she gets a call from HR shortly after saying, hey, you're going to have to invoke your FMLA. You're going to have to just take leave, or you're going to have to take vacation, and because, you know, you're not working in the capacity that you're supposed to be. But according to the EEO, a person that she spoke with was saying that if the supervisor approves these accommodations for her to, you know, kind of just work, take it easy, still work, but not do her normal work that would where she's restricted or whatever, it should be fine. And HR has no say in this whole process. So I suspect that this the woman from HR that was saying that, hey, you're going to have to invoke your FMLA and, you know, you can't do this. I suspect that she's a suspected racist. I haven't seen her. I haven't spoke with her, but basically there is a lot of confusion and stuff as of right now with her being restricted. Her supervisor is saying everything's good to go. He's signing all the paperwork that he needs to sign to approve her to, you know, have these accommodations. But HR is saying that, no, this is not approved. We're going to have to send her home, or without pay, of course, or send her to another workspace, find somewhere else for her to work. So, and I'm not sure if this suspected racist supervisor of hers, a white male, I don't know, he appears to be advocating for her, but I'm not sure if he's saying one thing to her, appearing to advocate for her and accommodate her, and then talking to HR saying something different or not. I'm not sure. But again, there's definitely some racism being practiced there somewhere. I you know, of course, I can't prove it at this point, but I definitely highly suspect it. And that's all I have to share for now. Thank you.
Much obliged. Thank you for sharing. My suspicion would be for the black female pregnant victim that they're probably going to say she needs a C-section, especially with the age thing. That was something we talked about in prenatal yoga teacher training, that there is not sufficient evidence to suggest that there is any danger to being over 35 and being pregnant. If you're healthy, you take care of yourself, there's no evidence that there's a problem, but they will say that a lot, that particularly black females, that was mentioned in training. Anywho, I suspect one thing I think that's important, going back to the Voltron effect, I mentioned that when I read the article about the Vivint homes at the beginning, the Voltron effect, I'm pretty sure that the white supervisor is having some interesting conversations, probably with the whites at HR and or other whites in the company, about this black female. Yeah, I'm sure he's having some very interesting conversations with them, where exactly as you said, it might be, who knows what he's saying to them. And then he comes back and talks to her, and, oh yeah, I'm with you all the way, and, you know, signed off on it, and I don't know what the problem is. These folks are crazy, but I got you. I mean, yeah, that happens all the time, and that's something that's, you know, good for us to keep in mind as well, even if you have a white person who is saying, you know, all the correct things to you, and they're going to do this, they're going to do that, you should still be highly suspicious. That's why it's always great, get it in writing. That was something that I think Emmy emphasized. Get it in writing. If they got glowing praise, get it in writing. That way we can get that in your permanent file when it's time for, you know, a review for a promotion or a raise. But having suspicion with these whites, they're probably saying something very different when we are not present. I have to think about that in terms of what I would recommend. If folks have any suggestions in terms of what you would recommend for that young lady, that would be grand as well. Pause for the late Bill Nunn, Radio Raheem, and Do the Right Thing. Again, white people cannot be ignorant about racism. And in my view, that's a racist joke, in my opinion, for a white person. And in that capacity, I don't think if he was talking to another white person, maybe I'm wrong. You all feel free. You can dial in and let me know, Gus, you're talking crazy and wasting our time on a Friday evening under the system of racism. But I don't think if he was talking to, you know, the white CEO of the company, or the white supervisor, or another white colleague, I don't think it would have been, oh, what kind of batteries? D, M, F, and D. You know, I don't think it would have been an impromptu recitation of, you know, the late Radio Raheem. We talked about that when they break into slang and they want to do their care. People talked about doing some of the lines from like Friday and Straight Out of Compton, Coon Flicks, I would say. These are just racist jokes, number one. But again, you cannot be ignorant about racism and say these things. Three, I would journal, workplace journal, that would be written down. Did Radio Raheem impersonation about the batteries or however, you know, to write that situation up. The talking about Suge Knight. And he killed O.J. Simpson. I know you said you didn't know the context, but just again, I emphasize not veering off and talking about things that are not related to the job, because invariably it just provides easy opportunities for whites to practice racism. That's what I view this as, that I'm just going to bring up this randomness. And, you know, I have no idea what you do, what your job is. I cannot imagine it has anything to do with Suge Knight, Tupac Shakur, and who killed him. I cannot imagine or why that would be, you know, being discussed. Once that even comes up, oh, got to get back to work. Talk to you later, Helen, Jim, Bob, whatever it is, Mr., you know, Rogers. But let's keep it workplace. That doesn't mean that you have to be mum and never speak, but we're not just going to be getting off on randomness. And in my view, I view that even as an act of racism, to be spreading gossip and rumor and innuendo about black on black conflict and anti-blackness, that another opportunity to practice racism. If folks have thoughts on what's been shared thus far, or if you have your own situation that you would like to discuss, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Hello? Yes, sir.
How you doing, Gus? The caller is on. You can call me Farrell. I'm calling from Orlando, Florida, Central Florida. I called like 2 weeks ago about the whole jail coat situation. I wanted to give you my name and whatnot. But had another incident in the workplace happened on earlier this week. Me, another non-white black male and a non-white, I guess you would say, Puerto Rican male. We all work in the same area. And the boss comes over and he's like, you know, let's say the other black male, his name is Gary, and the Puerto Rican male is Tim. He's like, hey, I'm going to start rotating you, Gary, and Tim in the front, you know, one a day. What now? I'm going to go, okay, that's cool. He's like, yeah, I sent Tim yesterday, and let's say my name is Joseph. He's like, and I'm gonna send, you know, Tim up there today, and I'll probably send Gary up there tomorrow. I'm like, okay, you know, that's cool, or not. And then
Are you with us, sir? May have been disconnected. I will keep an eye on the switchboard, I reckon. And then if he's able to dial back in, I will get his line and we'll pick back up from, I guess, this shifting of who's going to be out front. Sounds like it could be an illustration of racial showcasing, but we shall see. The number again, 641-715-7255. 3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Others who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Folks are spectating. This means that everyone is doing wonderful on the job. Oh, I was going to. Is this our caller who's saying, I guess, fictitionally, Joseph for the story? Can we get you back, sir?
Yeah, I'm back. I just lost service. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How did you want us? What did you want to be called, sir? I know you said Joseph was the fictitious name.
You can just call me Pharaoh. That's fine. Pharaoh. Fine.
Got you.
But yeah. So as I was saying, yeah. So let's say Joseph and I'm Gary, and the other guy's Tim. So he was speaking to me, saying, "Hey, I'm going to send Joseph up here," and then he's like, "And then tomorrow I'm going to send Gary," and I'm like, "You mean Tim?" He's like, "Yeah, whatever," and then walks away. So basically, you know, he was calling me the other guy's name, but I just took it as, you know, yo, hey, just another nigger. No, you guys are all the same, whatever. I don't care about your name. So I just take it as, you know, they don't really, I noticed they, and it's not the first time he's done it. He's always calling me the other black guy's name and calling the other black guy my name. Like, he has no disregard or any care for who is who. You know, it's like, you know, hey, you're him, whatever. Just another nigger, go about your day. And it was just blatant racism. And another thing I noticed is in my area, in my workplace, there's not a whole lot of, I would say, white males as far as in the working area. All the white males are in management. So whenever there's, like, you know, a new worker, they're usually, you know, some type of Spanish or black, pretty much a non-white male. And, you know, they'll start working and you won't even know there's someone new working there unless you, like, notice it and exit, hey, introduce yourself or whatnot. But there was this white guy who started about 2 weeks ago. And when my boss brought him in, he was walking around introducing him to everyone. Everyone shaking him hand and, hey, I'm this and that, and he's from here and there. And I just thought to myself, like, now there's a new person that starts here every other week, and no one knows who he is until about a month later. But you hire one white male, and he just parade him around like, hey, here's a new white guy. He's probably going to be the new boss soon. it's just funny, man, to see how they operate on a day-to-day basis. And yeah, that's that, and just the fact of how they just don't have any, you know, any regard to, you know, calling someone by their proper name. I know Mr. Neely Fuller always talks about that, you know, call someone the name in which they want to be called. And especially in my work area too, you know, out of, I say, 30 people, there's only two black males, me and the other guy I was speaking of. So it's not like you have 25 other black males to deal with. You got to learn two names. And me and the other guy, we're very, you know, he's tall with dreadlocks. He's about 6'3" with dreads. And, you know, I'm 5'10" with, you know, a short cut. So, I mean, it's not even like we're even comparable. But he's just a blatant disrespect for name calling. Like I say, just say, hey, just another nigger. You're on my plantation. Get to work. It don't matter what I call you. You know what I mean. And that's how I took it. But that's all I heard. Well, that's all I had to say. Thanks, Chris. I'm at my line.
Wow. Much obliged, Pharaoh. Thank you for dialing back in to be able to share completely. I think the name, we talked about that for years. I know for some folks, that's one. At the knees, the great Walter Beach III, getting it at the knees, that every time it would be, you know, hey, I am Gary, and, you know, that is Joseph or whatever it is, every time, not letting that slide, and, you know, not having to be rude about it or anything. It's not like you have an army outside to go to war with anyone, but just making that a point, because I think that is a deliberate act of racism. every time is being done. I think you interpreted it absolutely correct. And yeah, I think that's Black self-respect. And just, I think it's important just in the workplace. You know, as you said, Mr. Fuller always talks about the value really in any environment of calling people what they want to be called, but certainly in a workplace. I mean, we should at least have the common courtesy, decency, professionalism. Man, that's the word I would, professionalism, to address one another by the correct name. I mean, and jotting down. What was the second incident, the other incident you addressed, Sir Pharaoh?
It was, in my workplace, you know, because like I say, we build boats. So I'm a gel coat technician. You know, I paint and spray the boats. And there's other guys who come in lamination. And me and the other Black co-worker, we're the only two gel coat technicians there. And everyone else is in lamination. But they're all Puerto Rican. They're all non-white, classified as Puerto Rican, all of them. And, you know, it's pretty hard work. We work long days, like 10, 11 hours, sometimes 12-hour shifts. And, you know, so a lot of people coming in can't handle it. So we'll have a new hire at least once every other week. But you won't even know he's new unless you're working directly with him and you see him and you know, introduce yourself. But there was my boss hired a white male back there. But when he hired the white male, he took him around, paraded him around, introduced him to everyone. Everyone knew who he was. But any other time he hires a Black male or any type of non-white male, just, hey, you're hired, go back there, go work. But when he hired the white male, you know, he was parading him around and making sure everyone knew who he was. And I just thought that was, you know, quite interesting to how he took the time to make sure we knew who the white male was. But any other time when there was a non-white male, he didn't, just total disregard, just, hey, whatever, get out there and work, and you meet who you meet. And that's what it was.
There it is. Reminded me. Thank you, sir. Reminded me of the caller in Florida. He said, I think at the beginning of the year, they hired a new Black female at the courthouse. And normally all of the new hires, they would get a nice little warm welcome and ovation. You know, meet Timmy, just brought him on to the team. Bravo. Woo, woo, woo. That they brought in this Black female and nothing. They, in fact, I think he said that they went around and introduced white people who had already been working at the company. They weren't even new hires, and they just, you know, wanted to give them a little, you know, how do for the day. And he had to say something about the new Black female being hired. That's what I mean. Deliberate. These are deliberate acts of racism, white supremacy. They hire a new white person and take him around the entire company. And oh my goodness, you have got to meet Jonathan. He is the greatest fella. In fact, meeting your new boss probably with that by the end of the week. But I mean, yeah, this is the system of racism, white supremacy, the plantation, understanding what it is, how it works, and taking that seriously in terms of everything that we do, everything that we say, being strategic, codified with that understanding, everything around us that is happening that is a part of the power dynamic of white supremacy, racism. Much obliged, Pharaoh. Others who dialed in, if you have comments on what has been shared thus far, or if you have your own situation that you would like to address, feel free. *61 if you dialed in.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida? Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Greetings, Gus. To the last caller, I would at least address the name calling, the out of name calling, because quite courteous in the conversation and into the entry level of the conversation, and to explain to the person who is calling you by someone else's name is that, you know, put it in terms of a question, you know, a clarity in the workplace, would be essential. And, my name is such and such, and that's the name I would like to be called by also, and not someone else's name. And, you know, see where it goes from there. And, of course, also, you know, noted down that you had a discussion with that person as far as that concern. Other than that, right, I just been contemplating whether or not I should bring up the idea in mind about possible suggestions for the lady that's down here in Broward County on what she should do in her workplace. But that's probably, that's not really relevant, because it's not like we're going to actually, she's going to be able to obtain any of these ideas. But just a thought that was in my mind, because she's just about on the news down here every day with this voting, as far as that concern. And, of course, everybody knows that is her workplace. But other than that, that was my suggestion to the prior caller.
If you're talking about Dr. Snipes, retired firefighter, Dr. Brenda Snipes, black female, I thought she stepped down.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought she. Yeah, that now, see, that happens a lot, too. With those situations, sometimes it can be with the racial showcasing. Where you get the job and then they blame you for a whole lot of things, so then they can fire you, or, you know, you have to step down in disgrace and all of this like that. That can be a big part of it, too. So just something to be mindful of. And we are in a system of white supremacy, so that can take a lot of different forms. You would be amazed the number of ways that can manifest.
Last I heard, she was contemplating resigning, according to the news anyway.
Yep, that's what I saw as well. One thing that I was going to say, though, and this is for any of us, and again, these are suggestions. I'm never speaking to anybody on workplace racism and saying, oh, yeah, I'm an expert on what you need to do on your job. That is never the case. This is just, you know, exchanging views and hopefully processing to the best of our ability in a counter-racist manner. Just processing what we hear about these different situations and giving out recommendations based on counter-racist logic. You are the expert. You know your situation better than anybody who is speaking here. All of that said, if any of us, if you're in a work situation where we're just basics, we're not being called by our correct name. It could be other things too. Unwanted touching is on that as well. You know, it could be a lot of other things, but just basics. They're not even calling us by our correct name. If we're in a situation where that's happening at all, much less repeatedly, and we don't feel safe, we don't feel like I can say something about this, I can get this problem, this mistreatment, I can get this addressed without, you know, being retaliated against or fired, we should like seriously consider, like, wow, like, how long am I going to stay here? Do I intend to be on this job for 5 years if they're not going to call me? Is that 5 years of them not calling me by my correct name? Like, what happens to your self-respect with 5 years of them calling you Gary when your name is John? Them calling you Samantha when your name is Terry? What happens to you? I mean, just as a victim, what happens to you? I mean, even a year, how long am I going to tolerate if it's that, or if it's unwanted touching? Just something to consider, in my view, with just some things that are just basics. If we feel like if I say something about this, I could lose my job. How long do I really want to stay in this environment? If it's that precarious for me to be here, that I'm going to have to endure, you know, some things that I think are just basics. We're not talking about, you know, you having a gold embossed nameplate on your desk, you know, just something to consider. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary on what has been shared thus far, or if you have your own situation, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard? This is Pharaoh again, if anyone wants to have anything to say.
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
All right. I just wanted to address a retired firefighter. Whenever he did call me the other black male's name, you know, I corrected him and said, "Hey, you mean Tim?" And then that's when the white male was like, "Yeah, whatever." And then he just kind of walked away. So, you know, at that point, I was like, you know, what do I do? And I've thought about what you said also, Gus, about, okay, you know, how long is, you know, can I deal with this? Or I do also feel as if I go to HR, I don't really feel much is going to happen. It probably just put a bigger target on my back. You know, it's like, okay, this is, this nigger's here is a little bit less confused. So, you know, what are we going to do with him? So, you know, I've contemplated that. And another thing I just thought about too is, I have a female friend who was a teacher at an elementary school, and I remember before from a previous episode you were talking about the racist white women and teaching in the school department and whatnot, and she had a similar incident the same week, almost the exact same day it happened to me, where this the assistant principal had been calling her the wrong name pretty much the entire year, and she finally addressed it, and she pretty much had the same situation towards the principal, like, oh, okay, well, didn't apologize, just like, oh, that's not your name, and okay, whatever, then just left it at that. But you know, I just feel that, you know, sometimes, you know, you may want to go a different route, but as a victim, you're like, okay, I can't just quit my job right then and there, it's my livelihood. But at the same time, you don't want to be, you know, just mistreated and not have any, you know, anything to do about it. So sometimes it's just racism, man. It's just, you know, it's just tough. White supremacy, it puts you in such a bind to where you want to speak up, but at the same time, you don't want to lose your job on the spot. So, yeah, that's all.
Much obliged. That, I mean, you said it perfectly. That's exactly what this system is designed to do. Have us totally stressed, exasperated. You know, do I say something and risk all of that? Do I just endure it and still endure the stress of having to be here and not being called the correct name, being mistreated? That's what the system is designed to do. I think with your situation, like you said, speaking up, you know, when he says it and saying, you know, you mean Tim or whatever the correct name is. I also think retired firefighter, his suggestion of question about, you know, do you think it's best for clarity? And I mean, it's probably a variety of questions that you could ask, but I'm a big for this situation. I don't know if this is something that I think this is an HR issue. I think this is a direct, you know, right with him type of thing that can be done. This is one I would want to do efficiently. Like, this is one I would not want this to be a 10-minute conversation. I would not even want this to be a 2-minute conversation, because I feel this is so rudimentary, and I would view that he's doing it on purpose. Now, even though I'm not going to talk to him like, oh yeah, I know, this is basically like you want to call me a coon, but you can't. So this is, you know, as close as you can get for right now. Okay, got it. But when we go into this, I would be looking for one question. Like, I'm going to see if we can make this like a 5-second conversation if we can, and have this problem resolved after the 5 seconds. If I can ask one, and it might just be what retired firefighter said, just for clarity in the workplace. How long have you been working there, you said?
I've been working there almost 4 years. Oh, and it's funny too, because he's called me by my name plenty of times. So when you just say he's doing it on purpose, it just clicked in my head. Like, he knows who I am, and he knows who the other black male is. And I've been there for almost 4 years. There's no way you don't know. But like you say, he's just doing it on purpose. Let me aggravate the nigga. Let me practice racism and white supremacy against him. It's just like, it has to be blatant. It's just, you just say this is blatant racism. He's doing it on purpose. It has to be.
I mean, that's just
I've been there for almost 4 years.
That's just my conclusion. Who am I? I'm just another victim of racism, white supremacy, just another Negro. Acknowledged. However, you've been there 4 years. You look at that white dude that they just paraded around and see if they got his name mixed up next week. I don't know if he looks like anybody else there or what have you, but I'm pretty sure, name tag or no, they will have his name. And he's been there less than 30 days. You've been there 4 years. Come on, man. Am I forgetting somebody? And it's only two niggers there. And I'm forgetting your name after 4 years. Come on, man. Come on. So you're doing this on purpose. This would be a 5-second conversation. Like, just when, whatever the question is, it could be in the interest of clarity or do you have trouble remembering anybody else's name here? That might be one. And just see what he says. But I would be looking for one question that I could ask. That's not me being uppity, but it gets right to the point about calling people by the correct, or at least calling me by my correct name every time and without fail, just to see if we can get that out as short as possible. This is, I don't think this is one that you need to go to HR. This is one of those just direct, I can speak to you, ask my question, or, and folks can think, if people can think of one question that would help to resolve this in as little time as possible. No repercussions, as I said at the beginning. Solving problems without creating new problems. If folks have a thought about one question or what you would say, short as possible, see if you could get this solved. Feel free. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed. We had other folks who had dialed in with a hand up, and then something happened where they got bumped off. Don't know if we had interference or something happened with their lines, but hopefully if they had an issue, they will ring back and we'll hear what, if they had a problem, I mean, not if they had a workplace racism issue. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. And I will again say, I do think it is important. I think for a lot of victims of racism, it is difficult. We hear so much. The system is effective when they propagate the mythology that white people are ignorant. That they're poorly informed. That was one of the things that I appreciated about the segment that we opened with, talking about how the importance of tracing the history of how management has evolved, especially in the U.S., to slavery. That is not white ignorance that allowed all of that to develop. You cannot be ignorant and dominate people for centuries. And I think it's very helpful in a work environment. I think it's not just helpful. I think it is healthful and conducive to problem solving, because you're able, I think, I know I am able to think better when I am not, you know, really, really angry and upset, when I can calm down a little bit, even if I'm still, you know, angry, but I'm not, you know, super, super angry, where I can calm down a little bit and still think about how I want to try to address the situation, that I can make better decisions in those situations. And I think for us, I think if on the job, especially if we can get to that point where we are really interpreting whatever is happening, they're doing this on purpose. This is not happenstance. This is not an accident. They're practicing racism deliberately. That's what it is like that. And again, that's not saying that you need to jump up and down or call them racist or anything. That's just, you might not need to say anything at all. Just in your mind, like making sure that you, we remember we are processing this correctly. Got it. That's what's happening here. I'm not going crazy. That's what it is. And, you know, moving forward with my, whatever that means, you know, I need to do, just making sure that I'm correctly understanding what's happening here and not, you know, thinking whatever else is happening with whites on the job. That happens a lot. And I think that adds to a lot of the stress that we have in the system. I will wait to see other hands. Not sure if folks are disgruntled about the switcheroo and the broadcast being Thursday instead of or being Friday. Apparently, I am still struggling with the Friday to Thursday transition. Or if people are just having a grand time on the JOB, if so, then make sure you invest. If things are going grand and folks are not having difficulties on the job, racism-notes.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. If you are having wonderful time on the job, whites are doing right by you, you're not having any issues, no Dr. Brenda Snipes for you, grand. It would be nice to let us know how you did that. I still encourage folks, if you're on the job and you're not having any of these issues, if you need time off, sick leave, whatever it is, and you get it without issue, please share how you got into that glorious position. We would like to know. Other folks who dialed in, I guess you're on the Vope line, Skype line, perhaps. Did you have commentary you want to share?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, this is Helen in New York. Hello, Gus, and to all the callers. This is what I've observed. Last month in October, the Mega and the Lotto was pretty high here in New York. So I noticed that my coworkers, they've joined a pool, and they will, you know, that means come together and they all put their numbers in or whatever. I think they have a constant set of numbers, and then they also put in some extra numbers. So put in your own numbers. So one day, one of the coworkers, the coworkers consist of non-white and white people together in this pool. So the non-white guy, his name, not his name, but he's from Spain. But he tans in the summer and looks white in the wintertime. So obviously the coworkers, they treat him like a white person sometimes, but sometimes not. Like in the summer months, it seemed like they mistreat him. Oh, sorry for the noise background. Hello. So the non-white male from Spain, he didn't have his money to put in for the Lotto or Mega, whatever, whichever one they're doing. So he asked one of the white guys to put him in. So the white guy said yes. And then as soon as the non-white male walked away, the white guy turned to another white guy and said, here we go again. Ugh. And I'm like, wow. And the guy from Spain, the non-white person, he doesn't know that they're talking about him, saying like how he doesn't have money just because he asked him to put him in. Like, oh, he's always broke and he never has any money. He always has a story. And so my suggestion to all the callers, don't gamble and don't join a pool with your work, with your coworkers, because that just opens up conversation and another way for them to mistreat you. Thank you. And I mute my line.
Wow. That's much obliged for sharing, caller in New York. What distinction, I guess, are you detecting when you say he's being treated like he's a white person when he doesn't have his summer color? What distinction are you noting where he's being treated white?
He's in the wintertime, he's allowed or he's invited to go out for drinks to bars. They pile around a lot. They seem like very jokey and, you know, talkative and stuff like that.
Do they invite any other non-white people to, you know, hang out, to go kick it or joke around with any of the non-white folks that work there?
Not really. Nope. Only like when someone's going to go like retiring or they're leaving, then, you know, well, they're having like a celebration. So that's different. But nope. Nope. No.
Interesting. I'd be curious to hear the discussions they have with him at those times, especially if they're going out for drinks, to hear, you know, how he's talked about or treated even in those times. But wow, fascinating. Wow. Context of white supremacy. Be alert.
all times. Those folks, I guess the racially ambiguous and seeing how they're treated on the job, that can be interesting, especially, I guess, this case you didn't give any examples of how he's treating you, but that can be an interesting study on the job. To your main point, I wholeheartedly agree, though, do not participate in any of those office pools, gambling, lottery, anything like that. I do not participate. You can say whatever you need to. It's against my religious beliefs to, you know, do the lottery. I just don't participate. I think it's a waste of money, so I just don't do it. That's probably easy enough. I think it's a waste of money. I don't participate in the lottery ever. But I would not do that at all. Exactly as you, that's pulling whites into your finances. And then God forbid, I think they had examples of this where I think somebody, if you win and now you're tethered to these whites, like for the rest of your life, like you all got it. Oh my God. Like, yeah, I do not encourage participating in any of that. Others who dialed in, if anybody has a great story, I guess, with being in an office pool where you won something and it worked out great for whites, you can let us know about that. But I would not encourage that at all. Much obliged for dialing in, caller in New York. Other folks who called in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Calling from Greenville, South Carolina. I have two quick stories that happened just over the last 2 days. I'll start with the one that happened today. A white female coworker was telling me about a show that she likes to watch on Netflix, a documentary about court cases from like the early 2000s. I cannot remember the name of the course. I'm sorry, the documentary, but that's probably not too important. But she was telling me about how when she was watching the show, it basically talked about how basically the court system was unfair to someone and how even now they're still in jail after about 15 years, probably in their early 30s. And, you know, how this person clearly did not get a fair trial. So after she spent quite a bit of time telling me about this show, I asked her two questions. The first one I asked her is, what is her definition of the word fear? And then she went on to explain to me, well, fear means that the person, at least in the context that she was discussing for this particular show, that, you know, this person should have got a fair trial, that, you know, they should have got access to a lawyer, because apparently this guy was interrogated when he was a minor at the age of 16 and he did not have a lawyer or an attorney. And then I said to her, okay, you gave me of what should happen in a fair court system, but you have yet to tell me what the definition of fear is. And I said, that's perfectly fine. It's a hard word sometimes. Okay. And then I asked her, what's the definition of justice? Because, you know, she says she's interested in law and stuff like that, even though she's a planner like myself. And when I asked her that question, both those questions, basically her response was, she literally made that sound, and then she finally responded, those are two hard questions. I thought that was very interesting. And then I was at an event yesterday evening, a little bit after hours for work. It was about an economic mobility forum that talked about how structural racism, the design of a city, and a couple of other issues account for the types of economic disparities that happen where we live here in Greenville, South Carolina. And this forum lasted for about 2 hours. They had a whole bunch of non-white people come up and tell their particular stories about how maybe, you know, they started from a poor background, but they were able to make it because they got access to scholarships and mentors as they were going through school, even though they might have had some hard issues as they were coming up and becoming adults. There was even, this one was a little weird, though. They had a white female who came from a prominent family, but her parents got divorced because, her elder brother died from cancer, and then they kind of put a strain on the marriage, and then they got divorced. But through it all, you know, even though she got into a dark, she got into a depressed place, you know, she was able to grow up, she was able to still do the things she wanted to do, she was able to find her now husband, who is a black male, and they now have two mixed children. And she said, she asked the crowd, if you think it's hard for me to be a white woman to have a black husband with two mixed children, you'd be wrong. There are way more harder things than I think about than having a biracial family. And to me, this was very interesting as well, too, because some of the data that was being presented, my friend who does data analytics, a black male who's quite a couple years older than I am, he did some of the data analytical work roughly 4 to 5 years ago. And at the time, his ideas and his data was rejected. And now we have a situation where 4 or 5 years later now, they're using the same information in data analytical models that they once rejected from him several years ago. So I wonder, my first question would be this. Is anyone else coming across these kind of situations where, you know, a black person comes up with a very interesting idea, they get rejected, and then all of a sudden it gets rehashed by a white person saying that they're helping people? And then, of course, you know, are people getting the opportunity to ask whether or not, you know, when people use certain types of words that work like fair and just, are they getting opportunities to ask people what are the definitions to those words? Because even when I come across people who are lawyers, I personally can't find anyone who would give me a straight up definition for those two words. And I'll mute my line right now.
Much obliged for the reports, sir. I misplaced, or I mistimed, really, the cowbell. My apologies. I think that's a great question about asking about fair and or justice in the workplace when whites are using these terms. I know Mr. Fuller said the same thing with the term justice. He said he was asking attorneys and they could not provide a definition for justice. And he said that was really significant. Like, these are people that are they work in the supposed justice system. And you're telling me that you don't have a definition for justice? Like, wow, what is going on here? But that ask, and especially I think the word fair as well, that is a great one. To ask, I think we had some query about that perhaps at the courthouse as well. I don't know. The television thing, that's another one. In this situation, if they're talking, as long as it's like your situation where they're just talking and then you can ask questions, that's phenomenal. What I would make sure listeners don't, it should never be we watched this and we're back and forth like, oh, this is my favorite show and I watched it. Did you see this episode? Like, no. Like, if they're willing to talk about this and you're thinking, oh, this might be an opportunity for me to learn about racism, white supremacy, I'll listen and perhaps ask a question. Exactly what our listener did. Excellent counter-racist demonstration on the job.
Can I add something to that? Sorry to interrupt you.
For sure.
Right after that conversation, I had a conversation with my mother. And she lives in New York City, and I do my best to call her several times a week just to check in on her. And I told her immediately about the conversation I had with my coworker, and I asked my mother specifically about those two words. Now, in the moment that I asked my mother about the word fair and just, she did not have an answer for me. But the moment I said to my mother that the word fair, at least in the context that we were talking about, it means right as white. And she immediately agreed with what I said after I explained the conversation I had with the coworker. Yep, and I'll leave it at that.
Black get back, yellow mellow, brown stick around. Context of white supremacy. The legend, the grandsister, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Context.
Can I be heard?
Oh, yeah. Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Yes, I was going to try to give an example to the last caller of a non-white black person who started some sort of idea and basically was shunned, and some white people came and basically using the same strategy, and they became successful and was credited for it. The best example that I can give is Mr. Curt Flood, Major League Baseball player, non-white black male, who probably would have went into the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. He was that good. But he decided that he had a right to go to any team with his skills, his talent, and he should be able to barter his talent to any major league team that he wanted to go to. And in turn, he was mistreated severely and eventually thrown out of professional baseball. And in turn, two white males, one of them, I think he was a pitcher by the name of Andy Messerschmidt. For some reason, I remember that name because I remember the last name Messerschmidt, which is synonymous with a German aircraft. But nevertheless, they were successful into the area of free agency, and the professional sports world has actually forgot about this very courageous black male who sacrificed everything for and got nothing, basically nothing but mistreatment in return for his sacrifice that he made. Did we read that book, Gus? I don't know for sure.
We had a guest on the program a few years back where we talked about Curt Flood's free agency.
Okay, somebody talked about it. Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be a good book to read. I actually read the book years ago, but that'd actually be a good book to read. But that's the best example that I can think of. And it's not really an object. I know somebody probably would think about a black person who invented something of a tangible of an object, but I just thought about Curt Flood as he was talking, and it is in the workplace.
I do think there are a lot of illustrations, though, to that point, Mr. Flood. I do know he does get mentioned regularly. Anytime if you hear conversations about professional sports and free agent, I mentioned Golden State, that came up, the name calling, Kevin Durant being a free agent and being able to go and get hundreds of millions of dollars, that they will say Curt Flood does not get any credit for that. He's the person that made all of that possible in professional sports to go out and be a free agent and make this big money on the plantation, to switch plantations. But he's not credited for it at all and did not profit for it in his lifetime and is largely forgotten. Most people don't even know who he is. And I think he played for St. Louis. I think we talked, that was all in the summer of Michael Brown Jr. and what have you. But I do think that is routine in terms of black people having ideas and them being ignored, and or they will ignore the black person and then a white person will come along and take credit for that exact same idea or concept that is led all the way black. That's the exactly what we started with. That is the history of white business practices, the theft of black intellectual property, the theft of black bodies, period, and all of that entails. But that is the whole history of white business endeavors, stealing ideas from black people, taking credit for them. I was trying to think of one specific example, but it's so many. I mean, Dr. Welsing, she even talked about how Mr. Fuller, that she didn't even have people talking about racism as a system until after Mr. Neely Fuller, that even that
was stolen. The way that many whites now talk about racism was stolen from black people who did not get the credit, recognition, haven't even solved the problem, but just stealing some of their language to refine the way that they deceive other non-white people. But that's legend in the system. If we have folks who are on the line here, if you have some, I guess, more current illustrations of that playing out or personal illustrations, feel free. Let's see. Others, if you have commentary on what's been shared thus far or if you have your own situation, line should be open. Feel free. Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. And speaking of that question, I think it was one where the gentleman asked if there was an idea that a black person or non-white person came up with. I can definitely say I encountered that experience where a couple of months ago, I was asked to, I guess, do a certain job, and I made a recommendation in all of the chaos. And I just said, hey, why not just bring a larger bin upstairs and everybody can just discard all of their documents and paperwork, all of the confidential paperwork, and put it in the giant gray bin. And the white person in charge just said, well, I don't know if we'll be able to do that. It doesn't take that long to fill it up or whatever. And then what do you know, 3 or 4 months later, they announced in the meeting the same exact thing that I suggested. And I wrote that down, by the way, because when things like that happen, it happens so smoothly. You might not really notice it, but that reminded me of that. My next incident is I came in to work on Tuesday after the holiday, and the white supervisor, white woman, she, because it's at least been at least about 14, 15 people, like no exaggeration, they've been trying to exert extreme courtesy toward me. So just like these random conversations, they keep coming up like, hey, you know, I heard you had some days off. I said, no, I was just off on Friday. So she's like, I said, wow. How much vacation time do you have? I bet you have about 6 months worth of vacation time. That has to be a metaphor, because there's no way I can accumulate that much time. And I was like, well, hey, I don't even know. Not that it matters, right? So I kind of asked the question. And she said, I guess so. So, and then she says, you know, I really admire you. You're just very positive, and, you know, you're very attentive, you're punctual in all of these terms. And I just said, thank you, I guess. And so I was walking off, and the thing that's interesting is that she has conflict with the black female that's in that department. I had just asked her about it. It sounded like he was interrogating us. So this same person was sounding this way on Tuesday. So next one, third one it leads into, where this person is like obviously consistently trying to impede me and the black female's conversation. So she was like, am I crazy, or does it seem like somebody's crying? I don't even know where she came up with that statement from. So he just said, I don't know. So she was saying something about, I guess, we got in there talking about something, and she used a metaphor talking about the people across the side of the building, because I work on the other side. So she said, sometimes I can go months without going to that side of the building. And she says, unless I have to go to the principal's office. So I said, is that a metaphor? And she said, oh no, not really. You know, I'm just talking about when I get in trouble. And then I asked, are we in the school right now? You know, are we students? And are you a teacher? Or, you know, what is this right now? And then the black female says, yes, she is being metaphorical. And she says, well, yeah, in that sense. So we have both caught her trying to make a slick comment or possibly practice racism right there. So that was two attempts at trying to interrupt the conversation. And my next one is, we have the non-white person who sits in front of me, who's only been working there for 4 weeks. The supervisor comes to tell me that she's going to be relocating back to the other side of the department to go to the front counter because the white person who applied to go up there, I guess didn't succeed very well or made mistakes. It just didn't seem like it was an honest explanation. So she applied to go to a new position, and they made this lady, the non-white female, leave after absorbing all this kind of training that we gave her. So I'm like, this has to be illegal. Like, this is incorrect, flagrant, or whatever. So I just kind of documented that because I think they did that because she told on, or what maybe somebody might say, snitched on other white women up there who were, I guess, she said, ganging up on this one white female, whatever that meant. Because I guess, you know, people don't talk to her or whatever. So I think they value this white employee over the non-white employee, over the non-white employee. So they called her into the office and they told her something. Didn't know what it was because they closed the door. I think they probably just told her, just make sure you don't tell blanks what happened. Figure me out or whatever, because they don't want me to speak out on another form of injustice. So she told me what happened. She said that there's a culture up there that she doesn't agree with. She used the term culture. And I say, hey, I can agree with you on that. So I thought to myself, if they thought that they could bring this young white woman back to where she was originally because of some mistakes and it wasn't fitting for her, why did they think it was good for the non-white females to be placed in that same environment? But I guess she's being treated okay. But my last one is, a few weeks ago, the warden sent me an email and she wanted to chat. She said, can we have a chat? Now, she still ain't really talked to me ever since that extensive report I put out on. And a couple other things. So she was basically asking me about when I access a certain record or a certain beat, a certain time, me and a black female and a white female. So I was the second of three people she spoke to. And she asked me, did I know of a certain person? But I was like, no, I don't know who that person is. So yeah, you know, well, this was, you. It says that I have blank, print out a report from the late part of January 27th to August 2nd to show that you accessed it at 2:02 p.m. So I'm like, I can't even remember that. So she said, the reason I'm mentioning this is because someone at the other building was accused of, disclosing confidential information on a crime victim. So I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. So I just told her I didn't know what she was talking about. And then when I left, I said to the other black female, I said, this is why I don't participate in any of these little pilots because of incidents like this. Because I know it had to be, I think it was someone who was classified as black who did this. So I was incorrectly associated with this person. because I am black myself. So she probably thought black and just categorize all of them as suspecting them of doing some kind of wrongdoing. And that's all I have right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Wow. You with the last accusation about the sharing of I guess the information was shared. So she comes to question about that. And you said, this is why I don't go to potlucks, just to make sure that I hear it correctly. You had the assumption that a black person would be accused of this type of thing, sharing private, confidential information. And so that's why you don't participate. That was your reason that you gave as to why you don't go to that those functions.
Well, what that was that, like, after, because she already knew, because she was the one I was spoken to first. So I went and talked to my departmental supervisor, black female. I said, you know, I'll be right back. And then when I got back, she already knew the other female, black female. She was like, oh, she talked to you too? And I was like, yeah, you know, what's going on with this? And then she was like, yeah, it was from a couple of months ago when there was a case locally that was being discussed, and I guess someone got online or whatever, and I guess leaked the information or whatever. So I guess that what triggered it, I guess, for us to click and log on to it, I guess, to see what case it was, because we had gotten a call in, or she got a call in, and she mentioned it to me. And then the other person looked at the case around the same chronological time frame. So she was basically trying to use that to say, well, hey, you know, I got a report saying that you logged on at it at 2:05 and she logged on at it 1:58 p.m. So I'm like, this is like the last part of July. And the person was apprehended like August 2nd or whatever. So I don't know if she was trying to. What is she insinuating with this? Like, I feel like I'm being, when I feel, it looks as though I'm being criminalized. That's what I thought of myself. And I told them that. And I said to the black female, and I said, now, this is one of the reasons why I don't participate in any of the food or whatever and all these activities. And the reason I said that it was a black person being accused of doing it is because I had heard about it from another source that it was a black person that had been accused. So I thought in my mind that I was associated with that person because I'm also black, and the person who's the defendant for doing this crime toward the victim is a black person. So I think that she was practicing racism, associating all of us together. So she also asked the white person so that I or anybody else can't say she's practicing racism. So, and she said to the white person, well, tell the rest of the others to gather any information that they may have had during that time period to see if they had that name. Like, why would I say I had something on that name? I don't even know who that person is. So that's what the context of that was. I said, that's why I'm not participating, because things like this keep happening to me.
Much obliged for the additional information. Going back to what I said at the beginning about surveillance, the upgrades to surveillance, like, we know exactly what you were looking at 2:15 p.m. Eastern Time on July 15th, 2018. This is the file. We saw you. We know you did it. And your cousin. Like, refining their means of surveillance. And again, none of us should be intimidated. Again, what I've been saying consistently, just knowing that up front, like, not being confused about that, not thinking that you got some secrets or what have you. This is the system of racism, white supremacy. That said, I think with the logic given about the potlucks, and exactly as you said, this is an act of racism where they're just associating all of the niggers together with this act.
I think is flawless. Incidentally, I would say I suspect that that sort of logic is widespread in any of the occupations where you have sensitive data of whatever nature, court records, or if it's, you know, credit card information, anything. It would not surprise me if that's just, you know, the thought that, you know, niggers are not careful with this sort of information. So I would be mindful of that if you're a black person in one of those jobs, at being very meticulous about making sure that you are very careful with that sort of information, not leaving documents out and chatting about, you know, whatever, just so that, oh man, yeah, spotless with the record keeping and all of that. If it's happening, if I heard that correctly, where they're saying in a meeting, you know, to make sure they're not share this information with, you know, this guy here, we don't want him to hear this and apply his, you know, counter racist nonsense, like, wow, I would definitely want to record that. And I mean, just processing that this is not, you know, McDonald's, this is not Taco Bell, this is not Walmart, this is the courthouse. Like, this, that word justice again. This is supposed to be the halls of justice here. And, you know, they're talking about having secret meetings, you know, this information about the workplace and the workings of the courthouse, but don't tell, you know, such and such. We don't trust that nigger. I mean, how is this happening at the courthouse? Like, what is that, the spirit of justice where we're concealing information about what happens here? We don't want this, you know, we don't want certain employees to know, you know, what's going to go down here. I don't know what they might say or how they might think about this. Like, that is astounding. Yeah, I would just have to have that written down in the notes for the day and continue to do more of, you know, what is being done if that is happening, where you are being given days off so they can have meetings and not have you present. And then when you're back, they have secret meetings and make sure we, or try as best we can to make sure the information doesn't get there, to continue doing more of what you're doing. And especially if that means asking questions, interrogating metaphors, Levitt, whites coming in to disrupt. And that's, I think a lot of folks have talked about that over the years, white people disrupting, seeing, oh, the black people are not name calling each other. Oh, man, this is not cool. We don't like that. Let's see if we can come in and start some fuss up and, you know, get some ruckus, get them calling each other names. That's what we like. That's lovely. Or to just be disruptive. We've had a lot of people who said that, too, where they might not come in and be disruptive, but they'll just come in and hop into the conversation where it was just the two black people. Now they want to come in and jump into the dialogue. So now it can be a group thing, and then they can take over and dominate the discussion. But being mindful about that, and then not just noting the metaphors being used, but you can just ask questions. And she's trying to pull a slick one. Oh, no, I wasn't using a metaphor at all. What are you talking about? And then just following the logic, paying attention to what you said. Is there a school here? Is there a principal? What's going on? Stay in the question lane. And she has to follow logic. Everybody can follow logic, even if she doesn't want to answer. We can just pay attention. Of course, you are being metaphorical. Absolutely. And racist to boot. Like, following logic, outstanding. Continuing paying attention to that on the job can be very helpful, because whites do the metaphor thing on a regular basis, the analogies, all of that. It can be very informative to be alert, mindful about that, and to just ask questions. You know, what did you mean when you said that? You know, just ask simple questions. You can learn a lot. Other folks, if you have comments on what's been shared thus far, questions, if you have your own situation, number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have, again, if you figured out some things that work well, I would hope after all this time that we at least have some listeners who have figured out some things that work well. I know Stacy did follow up about people who were on the HR project. So people
have thoughts or would like to participate, share resources with regards to HR activities for non-white people that might be helpful on jobs, let us know, untiljustice@gmail.com. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, thoughts, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Yes. This would not be exactly work in the workplace, but it's definitely work and definitely racism. Lately, I've read a few news articles where black females who were physicians who were rendering assistance, attempting to rendering service, and were disapproved, I guess that's the best word to give it, by white people. I think it was specifically white females have a tendency of doing this, being the culprit in most of the articles of this nature that I have read. My question would be, what would be the codified response that non-white black person that is rejected from performing a skill, a trained skill that could assist or save someone's life? What would be the codified response by that non-white person?
I'm not a medical official. However, I would think it might vary greatly depending on the situation. Like, what type of medical emergency is it? Like, is the person about to die? Like, if I don't, you know, attend to them in the next 15 seconds? And who is the person that is disrupting this whole situation? Like, I know for the doctor on the plane, it was a white flight attendant. You know, now white women, white people, period, are dangerous. That, you know, would be substantially right. Different from, you know, an enforcement official or an armed security guard, you know, coming up to, you know, say, hey, Negro, you know, who authorized you to do CPR? Let me see your credentials. I'm sure the situation would probably have a huge impact on, you know, what the response would be. You know, do you stop immediately? How much time do you invest, you know, wrangling with this white person? Like, I think that would have, and even your credit, like, are you a doctor? Are you a nurse? Like, what are your, you know, qualifications?
In these particular cases, I think the reason why they did make the news is because everyone that I read anyway, the non-white black person actually showed credentials in some cases. Actually showed their credentials, but still the white person resisted. And it doesn't have to be the profession of a medical profession like doctor. It can be a firefighter, just about anybody who has some sort of skills that are considered to be either life-saving or life preserving. It could be a non-white black person that's the enforcement official. I myself have been on duty with a uniform on and was challenged by law enforcement on duty with the writing on the back of the t-shirt, Dade County Fire Rescue. And on the front of the t-shirt, the emblem of Dade County Fire Department, which law enforcement officials are very much aware of those decals. wearing the uniform and was challenged, would be challenged.
Negro steel t-shirts, so, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, it wasn't just a t-shirt. If the pants and the boots and everything, the whole uniform, basically. But in my case, I continued working because primarily I was working, first of all, whatever I was doing to assist other non-white black people. For the most part, that's where I worked at, in the areas where non-white black people resided. In that particular case, I specifically remember it was in a black neighborhood, quote unquote, whatever that is. Area where black people are allowed to stay. That's a better identification. Just wondering.
Context of white supremacy. If we have any folks, well, as you said, it doesn't have to be medical background, but certainly medical background or any other field where you might be required to give some sort of medical attention or help or assistance to a person in need and be stopped. You know, racism, white supremacy does not pause for medical emergencies. So I don't know if we have folks in those fields. That might be something to codify, because as you said, I know that's not the first time. I think the situation that happened with the black female most recently, I think that got a lot of attention, but that's not the first time that I've seen a situation like that.
No.
And I've heard you mention before, the same thing, firefighter, whatever, where a person is there doing what they're supposed to do. And, you know, who is this Negro who authorized you to touch that person? And you stole a stethoscope, didn't you? Like, yeah, if you have your code about how to deal with all of that as best you can, have your credentials. I know for some folks, black people have said that's why they're kind of married to having their badge or whatever it is. If it's got their like medical ID that shows that they're a doctor or whatever, nurse, whatever, keeping it around their neck. So that they can be identified. Unfortunately, even that, I think you said with the black female, I think she had her credentials and, you know, she was still just another Negro. So if folks have comments on that, or if you have your own situation, line should be open. Proceed. Oh.
Hello, may I be heard?
I heard both of you. I will. I reckon.
I can wait.
All righty. Thank you, Ari. That's in Louisiana. I will defer to Stacy just because it's so late or early, depending on your perspective. Our timestamp, it is 3:04 a.m. Saturday morning. Stacy joining us live from London.
I guess let the other caller go ahead. I've just got to sort something out.
Oh, well, right on. All of that. Ari, thank you for your patience and flexibility.
No problem. Thank you, Stacy. Good evening, everybody. To the question that was posed about codification for medical emergencies, I'm not a medical professional. I have worked in the health industry, but and I have been trained in CPR. So I'm wondering if it might be just a good idea to codify in the manner to which, like, if the person is a non-white person that needs the attention, to provide it at, you know, be willing to provide it at that point. But it seems like people are reluctant to allow non-white black medical professionals to provide emergency services, probably when the person is white. So, I don't know. I'm just figuring maybe that was part of the reason why there was, you know, the questioning, who are you and are you really a doctor, you know, et cetera, if the person, if the victim at the time was a white person. And I can take feedback on that, I suppose. I did have a workplace racism, I'll make it short, substitute teaching, and it was a fifth grade class. We had a reading assignment, and there were some students in the class I did not know that are considered ESL, English as a Second Language. So when we were about to begin the reading assignment, a white teacher came up front. She didn't announce herself, didn't make it known if she was a paraprofessional, TA, you know, anything like that. And she proceeded to come up to the front of the class with me, and she just stood there. And so I kept going with the lesson, and I said, who would like to read? And there was a black African, come to find out, young man that raised his hand. He said he wanted to participate. And that's when the teacher said to me, well, he's not reading and she's not reading, and pointed to an Asian little girl. So I asked her discreetly, what happened? Why can't they read? And she was like, they're just not reading. And I'm like, I'm not following. I need to know what's going on. You know, I'd like to engage the students properly. You know, can you tell me? And I'm whispering to her so it's not, you know, on full display for the students. And she says loudly in front of the class, because I said so. So I said, oh, okay, well, you know, you really shouldn't do this in front of the students. I said, well, since they can't participate, what are you here to do that's constructive for the class? And so that's when she was like, well, I'm actually going to go to another classroom and help, you know, whatever. So I took that as a signal that she was going to go and tell on me, which she did. And later on that afternoon, I talked to the assistant principal about it. I said, you know, I had no problem, you know, once I found out that they were ESL students and she was an ESL instructor. I said, you know, I have no problem, you know, going with the flow. I just needed to know what was going on. And because I say so, it's not professional courtesy, especially in front of a class full of students, you know. And it puts me at a disadvantage. I'm the substitute teacher for the day, but I'm the teacher nevertheless. And so the vice principal, who is also white, was like, well, she feels like you should have just listened to her because she's the teacher, not a teacher, but the teacher. And I said, again, yes, she's the teacher, but only for the ESL students, not the class that I was in charge of. And it's not proper to just say, because I say so, I need to know what's going on. And, you know, I was wondering if I should have said, you know, I feel she was practicing racism. I don't know if I did the wrong thing by not saying that, but I definitely really felt like for a moment I should say, well, I feel like she was practicing racism because, you know, you get where I'm going. And it was a very deflating experience because once I talked to the young man that I found out was actually African, not only does he speak and read and write English, he also speaks three other languages, two of which are African dialects, and the third is French. So he could have participated, but she just, I don't know what her reason was. It just was very deflating and very discouraging. And I just took a break from substituting like the rest of the week. And that's all I have to share for now. Thank you, everyone, and have a good evening. I'll mute my line.
Wow, that's awful. I'm sorry you had to endure that. I mean, wow. To describe it as the deflate, I was thinking of that deflating for everyone involved. For you tonight, to then take the rest of the week off, the financial impact of that, and then just not even being in the classroom. Most of the people that I, or many of the people that I know who are educators, they enjoy. That's why they, you know, invested all that time and money, years to be an educator, and to then not do that because of this rate. Talked about that consistently. Racist
white women, one of their primary duties, educators, they make up about 70% of the teachers in the public schools in the United States, white women, that is their domain. And she functioned as such. I have to tell you anything. I have to tell you my name. This is, and we're in Louisiana. Like, oh man, you're a substitute Negro. I don't have to tell you anything. Just hush and, you know, whatever. I'll do what I want to in the classroom. That's exactly what it sounds like to me. And even for the student involved, like deflating for you, deflating for him. He could have participated. It wasn't that he was, you know, stunted. He absolutely could have been engaged. And again, just being an effective educator, like, whoa, let's share some information. What is going on here? Like, why can't they participate? What are you sure they can't participate? What I mean, none of that. None of the just practicing racism. I'm not even going to set this teacher up for success. And I'm setting a student up for failure. Low expect. That's exactly what Dr. Curry talked about in the Man Knot. Low academic expectations for black male students. Exactly what he talked about in the book that we read yesterday. Still reading. We'll be back next Thursday. But I think that's atrocious. I think you did phenomenal job. I do not think that that is a situation where I would have accused the white woman of practicing racism, even though I believe that is exactly what she was doing in every way. Racism against you, racism against the black male student, and probably all the other students that she's coming in contact with, too. But I do not think that that would have been the best way to approach the situation. I think, again, just going back to professionalism, are we setting up students for success, and particularly given the additional information that you got that this student can function, that she's not even sharing correct information, much less, you know, is she setting me and these students up for success? That's what I mean about sometimes it can be one question. Is this the way that we're, is this the best way to operate a school? So we get new students, you come here and you have information about these students, they're not going to participate. You're not going to share that information with me about why they allegedly can't participate. Is that the best way to operate a school? Is that the best way for me to function as a teacher? Is that the best way setting these students up for success? That's the type of question.
Go
ahead.
Mm-hmm. I apologize. Actually, I'm glad you said that because I did explain that to the vice principal. I said, you know, as an educator, when I see students are eager and they're voluntarily, you know, asking or they're volunteering to read, I said, it's my job to encourage that and to assist in that. And so that was part of the disappointment. I told him that, you know, knowing that this young man did want to share and did want to participate in a reading exercise, and for this lady who, like you said, she didn't even let me know what her function was in the class. She just walked in and walked up without saying anything to me until she saw that young man was going to participate. I'm like, I didn't know. I was like, this is so unexpected. And again, it wasn't professional and it wasn't courteous at all. Like, you know, just totally threw the situation off in the classroom for about 10 minutes, because then at that point, the students, you know, you could see some of them were second guessing me and my function as the substitute teacher, because this lady came and usurped my authority in front of them like that. I'll mute my line again. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Deliberate. And children are not ignorant, you know, and certainly many children, white and non-white, they're not totally ignorant about racism, white supremacy. If there are any white students present, they understand. If you follow the controversy from the recent weeks, they understand. But even non-white students, they're not ignorant. They can see that. Like, oh, wow, she's coming in. She's not even, you know, announcing herself. Even the non-verbals. Even though children, they have not, you know, read about, I don't think they have any courses, unless I'm totally clueless, about nonverbal communication in elementary school. But many children, they are perceptive enough to pick up on that. Like, oh, wow, this white woman is coming in and just totally taking over. Like, she's not, you know, talking. She's not sharing
anything, like just the total way that she's behaving in relation to the substitute teacher. They can pick up on that dynamic. So I'm not surprised at all that it totally disrupted what you were doing in the classroom. Deflating. That's exactly the word that you used correctly. That's by design, to take away your power as an educator and eroding that student, the non-white students in the classroom and the black male students, particularly that you're talking about in this case, eroding their motivation, their curiosity about the classroom. That's, you know, their function. Really, that's when I indict that 70% of white women teachers are saying that's what they are there to do. That is their primary role, practicing racism, white supremacy, area of education. You get to touch generations of non-white students and totally corrupt how they think about, you know, education, reading, the process of learning, and just corrupt that from the very beginning. And then the educate, I mean, oh man, the damage. But I've been just asking questions. I think you did the correct thing by not accusing her of being racist or saying that you thought she was practicing racism. And I think that's another situation of just asking correct questions, both with her directly. And then when, as you said, she was going to go snitch, you talked to the assistant principal, asking correct questions there as well to get this resolved. Just, and let me know in the future, is that the way, you know, we are, is that the optimal way, the best way to serve students? We have information. I go into a classroom. I don't even acknowledge the teacher. I don't even acknowledge the educator. I have information. I don't even share it with them. That's the best way to operate a school, to serve the students. I would just stay in the question lane and let them answer. Other folks, it was Stacy that was going to participate. I don't know if you needed more time or not.
I guess. I'm fine. And apologies for that. Just had to sort something out. And hello to you and the rest of the callers. To Princess, I think that was Princess who was just sharing. I agree with you. I don't think she should have said anything. But I definitely would make note of it. And if that teacher was still in that school, I would pay close attention to what she's doing with the students, because that behaviour clearly is not a one-off. In terms of my updates this week, I have been under racist attack. I started off on Monday. We had a mini away day for some of the people in the team. We were at another site, so we were walking back to the other one. And it was about five of us walking in a line. And so, you know, side by side, my manager was on my left-hand side, and there were some steps leading up to a university right on my right hand side, and there was a racist female suspect who she confirmed her racial her racist credentials, because she walked towards me. Now I couldn't do anything, obviously, because I had people on my left hand side, and I stopped because we were sort of directly in front of each other, and she said something which I wasn't sure what she said. So I was kind of trying to work out what it was that she said, and she decided she wasn't moving, and so I guess something of what she said must have been related to that start she was taking, because she then immediately pushed me out the way. I was so angry, I was so stunned, all of those emotions, but I actually knew I could not do anything back. My manager witnessed it. The woman obviously just walked off. She could care less. I don't know whether she realized I was with other people as well, or she just thought I was any nigger on the street that she could attack and who just needed to get out of her way. So my manager's like, oh my god, she just hit you. We just continued walking back to the office, you know, sort of in that direction, because I obviously I wasn't going to do anything to her, but I was like, my God, if I wasn't at work, And then my manager's finishing my sentence for me. Oh, you would have probably done something about it. I said, no, I would go and actually make it official, because what she just did there is assault. Note that, you know, she's obviously putting words into my mouth and claiming that I'm violent. Now, she's obviously not saying that in a hostile way, but, you know, she'll just drop that line in. And I carried on walking for a little bit, and I thought, oh, hell no. And I said, right, I'm just going to go and sort something out. So I left them to go off to walk back to the office. I realised that, you know, I'm in London, so there are cameras everywhere. I was walking past the university, so it's highly likely that they would have had cameras outside as well. So I went, I spoke to the security guards. They were non-white males. They were really good. They've taken a note of it and stuff. And I was really upset, actually, you know, because there's so much frustration in it, in that this woman could care less. She knows her power, because she didn't think twice about what she did. And I'm taller than her. She's, you know, and it's not the first time. I mean, I've noticed an increase in just, and it's mainly women who, when you're on your way to work or whatever, they push past, they push you, they don't care. It's just, get out of my way. And I'm talking about my soldiers. And so the security guard were really good, but they said they couldn't view the footage back. They would have to get their security guards. But I said, I'm just, obviously just checking, because I will report it to the police. I gave myself some time to go and do it. So my intention was to do that today. But I ended up in A&E because I think I've got repetitive strain from using the computers at work. So my intention was to go and report it. I'll have to go and do that next week. At the moment, I've got my hand in a splint, so that's another issue that I've got to resolve. And then the other racist attack was from another race soldier. I spoke about her last week, new female in my team. I've taken her off the suspect list. She's confirmed. Not that I was in particular doubt last week anyway. Now, where I work, most people are required to hot desk. And you will have a bank of desks for each team. Now, the way that my team operated in the past, they had enough desks for every member of staff. But people would still have to move around. So that there's a desk rotor done every week telling people where they will be on a daily basis. Some people now have to hot desk elsewhere in the building should there be not enough desks in the team, because the teams, some teams are larger and the team that I'm, sorry, larger than the number of desks that have been allocated. And that's the case now in the team that I'm in, because the team has expanded. Some people, about three of us, do not hot desk. We have permanent desks. I'm one of those people. I don't announce it. It just is, and I don't feel the need to announce it. Anyway, now I don't know if this particular race soldier has ever been on the desk that I've been allocated in the past, but most people, they'll come, they'll use the desk, and they'll go to another desk, and we haven't got pedestals anymore. We used to have pedestals where you could put your personal items in. Now the teams are just given what are called hot boxes. So they're quite small. You get a password, you carry those around with you to your location. But in principle, it's a clear desk policy. There's nothing clear in the building. The place is full of papers and everything else. But my desk, for the most part, or the desk where I'm allocated, doesn't have anything personal on there, with the exception to the side of where I sit. There's another sort of, it's all metal, but it runs the span of the floor. So it's like a rail, but it's a little sort of tabletop, if you like. But that's to the side of every desk, so it's not in anybody's way. And on that side, I have some cushions, because I have back problems. So I have some cushions for when I need to, and my hot box usually sits to the side. So this race soldier now, I noticed, and I mentioned last week, every time she's, I had to catch up with her last week, and she specifically asked me about, in the email that she sent, my experience of working in the organisation. And literally every time she speaks to me, she gives me her credentials about her 20 years experience in XYZ. And I know it's a way of her just trying to suss me out. I receive the information every single time, and I do not feel the compulsion to share my credentials with her. I'm not interested in hers. She can share if she likes. She doesn't need mine. Anyway, so she was on the desk this week. She packed my bags, literally. Everything that was on the desk that has been purchased for me by the organization, all the papers that are on the desk, and they're not a lot, but there were some papers, everything, things that were not in her way, so things that were to the side, including the cushions that just didn't affect her being able to do her job, she packed up the desk. And I came in and she had literally moved in, so everything that she was using was left on the desk, including her dirty teacup with coffee still left in there, and an empty plastic water bottle container that she decided she wasn't going to move. And that's the second time someone's left a cup on the desk with stuff, dirty stuff in there. And she wasn't in the following day because she only works part-time, so there's one day a week where she's not in the office. So in principle, she would have left her stuff all over the desk, including her dirty festering tea and coffee and rubbish, basically. So I returned the compliment. I packed her up, I packed her stuff, and I, including the dirty cup and her dirty empty water bottle, and I moved it to the side right behind me. So the racist suspect male who usually sits behind me, he also has an allocated desk. He wasn't in the office, so I moved all the stuff nearest to him. And I didn't see when she came in the following day. She came in earlier than I did, but she got the message, because for the last couple of days I haven't had any fake hellos. So I think she's festering. But she was obviously making a point, because, you know, if the principle of what she was doing was to say, don't leave stuff on the desk, I'm not sure she realises I have a permanent desk. But, and so, you know, if I didn't work from home one day a week, the only person who would be using that desk is me. That's why I tend not to move anything off of there. But there's literally nothing to stop people coming and working. But yeah, I returned the compliment for her. So if she was trying to make a statement, and I'm sure she was, I thought, okay, well, I'll do it back to you, and then what can you say? And then I thought, you know what, this is the second time somebody's left their nasty stuff, you know, and I'm not talking about papers, which is bad enough, I'm talking about the cups of coffee and whatever on the desk. I'm going to switch my work from home day, because I was thinking about it anyway. So I'm now working from home on the same day that she works from home, which is the Wednesday, the middle of the week. That way, and I was planning to do that because someone said to me they work from home on the Wednesday to make the week seem shorter. So I thought, well, let me try that myself. So that was my intention. She just speeded up the change for me, because I have a feeling she would have done it again. So I'm just going to neutralize her ability to terrorize me. But I'll mute my line there, Gus, just in case anybody else wants to give an update.
Neutralize her ability to terrorize me. Said like a authentic, attempted counter-racist. Love it. That is what we should be striving to do. The last portion that you shared about, I think, is extremely important, emphasizing, I've said consistently, that we should not use that or be mindful about those possessive adjectives in the workplace, my desk, my chair, even my job, racists can come and repossess all of that and do frequently. That, you know, we should be mindful of that. And what I've said about leaving items on the desk, our possessions, for a variety of reasons. We should only have items there that are related for the job. But we got all layers of the tackiness, them coming to box up your items and, you know, put them to the side and then leaving all of their filth and trash to fester on the area. I love it, returning the favor in kind, which just shows that they are deliberately treating you in a way that they know is not acceptable, that they would not treat another white employee that way. They wouldn't have just boxed up all of their stuff and thrown it, you know, wherever to the side. But this is totally unacceptable, the way that they were treating you. And you just doing the exact same thing to her that she did to you. Now she's upset. I'm not even going to have the pretense of being courteous to this nigger now. Like, oh, how dare she, you know, box up my filthy teacup and everything together. But that's not being surprised, not being stunned. I love it, changing up the day that you work from home so that you can minimize access with this confirmed racist, I think, as you were saying. I'm so sad or sorry to hear that you were physically violated. I think this is at least the second time that you've talked about being physically assaulted on the job. Something that should be totally unacceptable for all of us. Again, why I said we should all have a code, because it just seems to be so prevalent in terms of some sort of unwanted touching, sexual or out and out violence, that we should have a code so that that's another one that we're not surprised by. The tackiness, I appreciate that you noted the tackiness of your white employer who did not focus on the violent assault that you were subjected to. It was, oh, if you weren't at work, you would have got ghetto. You would have, you know, went upside her head, wouldn't you? Like, what? Like, no, I'm a victim of racism. Just pointing out that I was assaulted and that I would have, you know, taken time to get the authorities. I would have had more time to deal with this in a correct manner. The fact that I was terrorized out on the street. But again, just showing that's how we're thought of. That's niggers in, you know, any setting. I'm glad you were able to go and contact them. I hope you're able to follow up on that to hopefully charge this person with assault. I think that's also important that you noted that at least you said this was a white woman that attacked you. It seems you said an increase in white women being violent in public spaces. I know that it's been here in the States an increase in violence, period, the shootings and all that, which seems to be every day. But just being mindful, because a lot of times that anger gets focused on the anger and violence gets focused on white men. And I think that that is extremely important to be mindful that white women are every bit as capable and frequently demonstrate that they are all about being violent, terroristic towards black people, non-white people as well. So definitely be mindful. Let's see. Others who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. Let's see, Farrell, did you have additional commentary? Were you just listening, sir?
Yes, I do, guys. Give me one second.
For sure. While we're giving him a moment, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll see if Pharaoh is ready. Oh, well, while we're waiting for Pharaoh, the other caller?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. I have a test that's happening on Monday. Third time I'm taking this test, and hopefully this time I pass it this time around. But as I'm getting ready for this test, I've been reading a couple more books to help me prepare for this test. And I came across a book called Reading and Planning Theory. And because I do planning and engineering. And there was a very interesting passage in the book. You know, a lot of Black people, you know, we do our best to go into whatever professional field that we go into in the hopes that we can help Black people in whatever way we can. But, you know, we quickly find out that, you know, that quickly goes awry. And this book that I'm reading, this book is from the Planning Association Library. And it had a very interesting chapter that I would like to read real quick. Let's see. Here it is. In terms of the Herbert thesis, our interview question is asked about only three dimensions of the six holistic concerted systems. Public administration researchers have found that those racialized minorities working in the public sector and offering better service to racial minority communities may pay a price. One of the first public administration scholars to describe that price was Adam Herbert, 1974. Those whose work laid the groundwork for more recent research. According to what is known as the Herbert thesis, minority public administrators can find themselves facing at least six key dilemmas. The first is that their workplace may expect them to comply with official policies, but those policies could be in conflict with the goals of the minority community. Two other concerns were, two, they are likely to be assigned to marginal job categories which deal with minority issues, but true resolution of those issues could be very difficult to achieve. And three, they may experience pressure from their colleagues to support the organization and its goals rather than to support the minority community's interests. Finally, three other concerns were, four, the minority community expect them to be accountable to their community in spite of their work situation demanding accountability to the organization. Five, they may indeed feel a strong personal commitment to carry out policies that promote the interests of the community. But six, they may also feel pressure to ignore the interests of the community in order to advance in their personal careers. Such professionals must decide how to respond when competing goals confront them in their work, and their work may indeed suffer because of the efforts involved. As I was reading, there was one more part of it, further on in the book as well, too, diversity in planning, that word diversity. As we have noted, these thoughts need further explanation and research, yet if our conceptualization of these issues is correct, one theory to be tested is that minority race planners in fragmented metropolitan areas can help improve the planning profession for minority race people in matters such as access and connection. If this is indeed true, then at least one appropriate course of action would appear to be fairly obvious. This would be to enhance efforts in minority race recruitment and education programs as well as professional settings. In the reasonable hope that such acts will give greater voice to those who have little. Another theory to this test is that such minority race planners face major institutional barriers to their success and effort comparable to those identified by researchers in other professions. If this is indeed true, much wider institutional and bureaucratic reforms would be necessary, far beyond simply recruiting racial minorities to the profession. To me, as I was reading through this book, to me, that said it all right there. You know, I'm not saying that Black people shouldn't try to, you know, push forward in their careers or anything like that. But when you find yourself in a situation where you're supposed to be like the middle person between your employer and whatever non-white community that you're being asked to serve in any capacity, whether you work a public job or a private sector job. Be careful to, or at least try to ask questions along the lines of what is the purpose, what is the goal here, and make sure that both sides, whether it be the non-white community and the employer, both agree or disagree on what the goals are, so you're not the person caught in the middle of that situation. And then I do have a question for you, Gus. About a week or maybe 2 weeks ago, I sent you an email about a potential interviewee, a Black male named Derek Avery, who was doing work in Texas. I forget what city in Texas. By chance, did you get that email? And I'll mute my line.
Yes, sir. I did get the email. We will see if we can get him on the program. But yes, I did confirm. Got your email. As for the readings and black people taking these types of jobs, I concur. I'm not discouraging. If anybody works in this capacity, I'm not saying it's anything incorrect about that, or if you are seeking to work in that capacity, nothing incorrect about that. Just that whites, racists, have designed these positions to fail. They do not. It's a lot of times the logic is set up that we have these positions, minority, even the use of those terms, that we have these positions, minority such and such, Office of Minority Affairs, and now diversity is the term. So now to be Office of Diversity Affairs. We have all these niggardly terms. Once we get somebody who's in this position, they will help address the problem of racism. That is flawed logic from the very beginning. The white people that are there are practicing racism, and they do not need this position to end racism. If they were really serious about it, they could just, you know, do it themselves. You don't need, you know, to hire said Negro official. Sometimes they get a white person to be the head of minority affairs. So just having that in mind, these positions, you know, they're not designed to solve the problem of racism. Most of the time that is just giving the appearance that we are, you know, trying to solve the problem of racism. Wink, wink. So just understanding that. And I think, the non-white person, if you understand that going in, probably be less stressful for you, and everyone else around. When you do not understand that, you don't understand racism, then I think it can be a lot more stressful. Some of those were even laughable, like the black, so-called black community or black people, minorities, not being able to hold them accountable. How would they do so? We have a pretty good sound clip of Mr. Fuller talking about that, but oh, Pharaoh, did you get yourself together, sir? Did you want to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm together, guys. two quick things, really quick. As far as you know, racism in the medical field. When I got, I did 4 years in the Marines, and when I got out the military, I went to firefighter school here in Central Florida in Orlando, and you know, all firefighters have to be at least EMTs or paramedics, well, at least EMTs. And I remember when I was in school, you know, you have to go through, I can't think of the name of it, but you have to basically do like 24, 48 hours of, you know, in a hospital and on the fire truck. And I remember my first day being out on the fire truck, we got a call from a white male who was having a heart attack. So I remember when we got there, you know, I'm, you know, in school and stuff. So I got the equipment to put the heart monitor on him. And the white male was like, when he seen me trying to touch him, he was like, oh, no, 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 anyone but him, anyone but him. And, you know, back then, this was like 6-7 years ago, I was a lot more confused. And when he said that at first, I didn't really, you know, think anything about it. And he said it again, and someone else was like, the other firefighter came and moved me away. And when I think about it now, I laugh, and it's I don't know if it should be funny, but I think about how, wow, like, this man would rather die from having a heart attack than have a Negro come in and touch him and help him out. And it's just wow, man. And thinking about it again with my boss, all this stuff is coming to me about my boss from my job. He's a real, like, he's, I say he's pretty refined racist, but a lot of times his racism comes out. Like, he has a sister, and like, he tells a lot of his business. And he has a sister who was in a tragic arrangement and has two black daughters or non-white daughters from a black male. And he was telling me one time about how, you know, he had his two nieces for the weekend or whatnot, and he was like, he wanted to take them somewhere, but, you know, one of them has good hair and the other one has just such bad hair, and he didn't know what to do with them. You know, he was like, I didn't know what to do with her hair. And, you know, she had, you know, she has kind of that, you know, just that that bad hair. And he's telling me this stuff, and like he just says this stuff with like just no kind of like caution. Just he just tells me all this stuff as if he's not worried. Like, you know, just I'm not gonna go to HR. I'm not gonna say anything. But a lot of stuff is coming to me about him. He's real refined in his racism, and he even describes his sister as, you know, my sister, she's a, you know, white girl with a big old butt, you know, and that's why I know black men like those girls with big butts, especially white women. And a lot of stuff happens at that place. And what I think I'm gonna start doing is I want to start keeping a journal, and I keep saying this, but I'm really going to start writing this down, even if I have to stop doing my job at work or go to the side and put it in my cell phone and then write it down later on about all the, just the little, the racist activity and racist moments that happen at my place of, at the plantation, basically. And I mean, my line for now, Gus.
Would be worthwhile, not just for you, I think, pretty much all victims of white supremacy, because as you were saying, just things come to you as you, all of us, as we get a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, some of the things that happened to us previously, we have a better understanding for why those things happened and just all of the circumstances that surrounded those particular events. That happens to many victims, I'll say it that way. So I think journaling can be very helpful, and that way you can preserve more of the details as they are fresh in the moment. Can be very, very helpful for workplace racism and just, you know, understanding racism, white supremacy, and yourself. It doesn't have to be massive. It can just be a few minutes. It can be a brief investment. 5 minutes, you know, after you get home, sitting on the couch, as you're unwinding and you just jot down a few notes about this happened, this event, whatever the case may be, it can be really impactful. I guess the event from your medical history, I think there are quite a few of those types of situations where whites, even in facing mortal danger, valued racism, white supremacy more than anything, or at minimum, their commitment to racism, white supremacy put their life in jeopardy. There are too many illustrations of that to talk about. Mr. Fuller even talks about one where it was white people. They were on a boat. It was sinking. And some non-white people used the rope or ladder, whatever apparatus that they were using to escape the sinking boat. The non-white people touched it. And the whites, the racists, said, ugh, you let the Negroes touch it. We don't want to touch it. And they died. You mentioned that anecdote. It's tons of those, especially that pop up in the medical field about black doctors. I played that clip from the black doctor on NPR before. I should play it again for workplace racism, but he had tons of examples where he was trying to help these racist patients with all of their ailments, and they're practicing racism. Who is this uppity nigger in here trying to tell me about, you know, what's wrong with my body? Other folks have comments or responses to any.
Oh, I was going to say, I had one more thing that just came to my mind again, Gus, if you didn't mind.
Yes, sir.
With my boss again. So like I say, I'm a gel coat technician. So, you know, we have different types of paint or gel coat. And one of the colors that we use is called Desert Sand. And basically it's, you know, white people aren't white. I've never, like I've heard you say before, you know, you've never seen a quote-unquote white person, the color of a piece of paper, but we have this gel coat called Desert Sand, and it's basically the color of a white person. And my boss one time was trying to get me and the other black male to, you know, hang out with him one weekend and go to the club and the bar, and me and him were both kind of like, you know, just giving him the cold shoulder, but you know, like, hey, you know, maybe we'll do it, maybe we're not. And he told me and the other black male, he was like, well, you know, before you guys can hang out with me, you're gonna have to go paint yourself in the desert sand. That was the name of the gel coat, in the desert sand gel coat, you know, because, you know, you guys can't be coming with me looking how you're looking. You know, you gotta put yourself in the desert sand gel coat, and then we can all go out and hang out, have a good time. You know, just No words, man, but racist man, racist woman. I'm done, I guess.
Desert sand. Wow. And again, and I am of the view, just following logic, you can't be ignorant about racism and make, put it in quotes, jokes like that, that you all need to, you know, get on some of that desert sand if we're going to hang out. You can't be ignorant about racism and make a comment like that. From the caller previously, D Batteries, quoting from the Spike Lee, you can't be ignorant about that, and especially if you do that and attend, or it's not attend, that's reserved. You make those sort of impressions when you're around the Negra employees. You can't be ignorant about racism, white supremacy, and behave like that. That's what I mean. We should have the same understanding about what it means to be white when they come in and make these jokes and comments and flex their expertise about being racists. We should have the same expertise about, you know, who we're talking to, why they're doing this. Like, oh, okay, I know what it means to be white. I know exactly why you're quoting Radio Raheem right now, talking to me, a black male. I know exactly why you're doing that. Did any other folks have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Oh, yes, sir. Thank you very much. I had three quick ones. I was going to send you an image of a candy that a customer gave to me, and I don't know if anyone has heard of this brand. It's called Ginger People, and it says Gin on the wrapper. So I call it Nig, like G-I-N, and I was going to take a picture of it. But I got to find what I did with it. It should be, maybe you can search it on Google, but it says, I think it's called the Ginger People. So, you know, obviously, become the anagram, it made you think the Nigger People or whatever. It's like a yellow and red color scheme on the candy wrapper. I think that's what the brand name is. And my next one is, there was a comment that was made when I was walking through the area, in the child support area, and this lady, a white woman, was talking to a black female about her boyfriend, and she was saying that he's from New York, Puerto Rican, so that's a cowbell. And she was saying, like, how he likes whatever. So she said that she was in that speech metaphor and said that some ignorant person asked if he was a kid. And she was just kind of appalled or whatever, like, I can't believe they asked. And she asked me, did I know Puerto Rico was part of the United States or whatever? So I said, of course I said. And then so she says, oh, well, that's good. Or ahead of the curve. Okay. Like, and I thought about the bell curve, I think, or whatever. IQ. Maybe that's what that's referring to. So that was a statement she made. Ended it by saying that talking to black female, you know, again, his face and things like that. And I just like how his hair is so curly, and it's almost like you can hide a bomb in it. She says, like, you can hide a bomb in it. So I was like, oh my God. So I kind of just walked off. I overheard that conversation. I don't know what she was going with. And I had a third one. There's a conversation that occurred upstairs. The JH is basically saying that she hadn't seen a black person until she was 13, so she was from California, and she said that a lot of that baggage got rid of when she was over here to Florida. She was going to high school. And they had black prom queens and white prom queens and prom kings and stuff like that. She didn't know whether it was natural or if it was forced. Now, this is what she's saying. So, said when it comes to that, she don't believe anything about them working hard because she saw that they was sitting on the sidewalk every day when she was going to school, so she can't believe that. She says, other than that, you know, I left a lot of my baggage behind. I don't know what she said. And that's all I have.
Baggage. The Negras are known for being violent, so it's no surprise that they use their kinky, curly hair to hide Molotov cocktails and weapons of mass destruction. That they were stopping black people at the airport, Homeland Security. They had the same conclusion that Negras are probably sneaking explosives, IEDs in their afros. We need to check them. The black females, that was within the last one or 2 years, I think. And again, the metaphors ahead of the curve. We got a smart one here. Better watch this one. Seems like they say that's the same conclusion they're coming to all the time. We got a smart one. You got to watch this one. He's a little bit ahead of the curve. We better be mindful. Other folks who dialed in, well, I guess it had to be 30 seconds, unless you can get it in 30 seconds. We are about out of time. Did anybody have anything they need to get in the last 30 seconds? Bill Maher, I didn't even know. Charles Murray, I think that's one of the co-authors of The Bell Curve. Bill Maher has him on his program regularly, like 3-4. I had seen him on Bill Maher's program multiple times, but I didn't know that he was one of the co-authors of The Bell Curve. I didn't have, and he wasn't, like, when he has him on the show, he wouldn't say, oh, this is the guy that wrote The Bell Curve, because he wrote, I mean, that came out like 30 years ago. He's written lots of other things since then, but he would, you know, just mention some of his other newer books, and it took a while before it was like, oh, that's the guy that... Bill Maher. Anywho, we'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Tune in if you would like. Oh, I forgot. How could I forget? Gin Gins. I have Gin Gins in my temporary flood residence right now by the ginger people. I am a huge ginger consumer, have been for almost the entire calendar year. Fresh ginger and lots of ginger people products. They have the best ginger beer. Their Gin Gins, I have them. They have all kinds of ginger stuff. Like, it's amazing. They, anyway, but it certainly could be the little anagram, the candy that I have, it's ginger candy. It does not have the figure, the ginger person on there. What do you call it? The logo or the, I want to say minstrel. That's the word that I want to say, but that's not the correct term. The mascot. That's what it is. I had the wrong M word. The mascot, for the ginger people. It is a piece of ginger. It's a ginger root, but they've anthropomorphized it. Woo! So that it looks like a person. But certainly, Gin Gin, Nig Nig, absolutely. Just have to move a few words around. Like I said, the candy that I have, it's small. They're very small pieces of candy, so it doesn't actually have the ginger figure on it. It just has Gin Gins and from the ginger people, but you'd have to see it if you take a look at their mascot to see if it reminds you of a black person. But yes, I am very familiar with ginger people, have had lots of their products this calendar year, and I don't think I had thought of the ginger figurine as a black person, although I will certainly be open to the idea that maybe I was not thinking correctly, because I was just like, oh, it's such great sugar high. I don't have a whole lot of sugar products in my diet, so this is one of the few products that I have that has sugar, so it could just be I'm not thinking correctly because, oh my goodness, I'm about to get a rush of sugar.
could be. Any other folks? Did when you saw the mascot, the little ginger figurine for the ginger people, did you think it was minstrelly?
See, because actually I haven't gotten around to doing more research on it. I just kept looking at the candy wrapper because she gave me just like one piece of it, and she had some in her hand. So she just kind of gave me one because I was printing out a copy for her. So I just kind of just saved it on desk, whatever. Then I was just looking at it, and I was like, man, like, I said, isn't that interesting that it says Jim on it? And this is like maybe like a day or two later. And I was like, you know what? I should share this on the program because I know a call, I think, mentioned the term gender like on an internet meme or something. So I kind of just connected to. I haven't really gotten a chance to see like a visual image of the mascot. I just saw like an individual candy, just like a small piece of candy in a wrapper. So I'm not sure what the mascot could look like. I'll have to look it up myself.
Okay. Well, if folks look at it and you think it is a minstrel, then maybe Gus was fooled, because I've had lots of their ginger beer. Like, it is, I love ginger beer, and they make the best ginger beer that I've had. I've tried many, many brands. Although they do have fresh, frickin' Seattle, they have fresh on tap ginger beer that I have not tried. But if that's supposed to be really good, but you'd have to like go, it's almost like going to a bar. Like, I don't, eh. Anyway, other than that, the bottled ginger people, ginger beer is amazing. I don't know what that has to do with work. Oh, you got the candy at work. Yes. Ginger beer, amazing. I hadn't thought of it as being a menstrual figure. You'd have to look at it and see. The ginger people, you can go to they have a website and all the stuff, social media stuff. You can look. They even sent me ginger beer with the flood. That was why I started consuming their products. I got ginger beer as a gift after the flood, when I went to the first temporary flood residence, and it was so delicious. I emailed them to say it's been so terrible and we're flooded, and you know, I got ginger beer and it was great. And they were like, oh, that's so sad, we'll send you free ginger beer, which they did. But yeah, they have, I never thought that could be another one. Maybe they wowed me over. They just sent me, that's all it took to send him a few free ginger beers, and he was looking right at a minstrel the whole time and didn't even think of it. Maybe. We'll be here on the compensatory call-in tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you check out the mascot, you can let me know tomorrow if you think it is a minstrel. Very popular in these parts. I know it is kind of pricey, some of their products, but white people are big fans of their ginger beer and some of their other products. Very, very big fans. Anywho, compensatory call in tomorrow. I hope it has been worthy of your time and energy. Always feel free to drop an email if you have comments or suggestions or your own situation for workplace racism, and we can read them on the broadcast. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's do all that we can to preserve our brain computers so that we can crank out solutions to solve the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up each and every time we are in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.